You've laughed with the award-winning American version of The Office. You've cried with the critically acclaimed American version of Broadchurch. Prepare to shrug your shoulders at the highly derivative American version of Doctor Who. He's back, and it's about time.
Jan, I'm sorry. I'm regenerating.
And I'm... American!
Doctor Who, like you've never seen it before.
Hold me, Doctor Who, and kiss me like you've never kissed me before.
Cool beans, my Russian doll!
Oh. Oh.
Taste my sonic luck, Sontaran scum! American!
The Doctor, the enemy of the Daleks!
Prepare to die, Daleks!
I have the right!
I'm Time Lord Victorious!
Yeah!
American!
Danger has a new name, and that name is Doctor Who, Dark Odyssey. Atway Atway is Doctor Who.
American!
Featuring Paul Thomas Manns as the Master and
Maren Lalonde
as the buxom Time Lord-loving Russian spy who loves to love him.
Hello everyone and welcome to the Doctor Who Show, where too much Doctor Who is barely enough. This is Series 1, Episode 3, and I'm your host, Rob Irwin. How are you? Now, before we get into this episode, many of you are probably wondering what on earth happened before our credits. Some of you, meanwhile, might have recognised a voice or two and realised it was our friends of the show, AM Audio Media, up to some mischief. Essentially, let's time travel. Let's go back 20-odd years when, for a moment in time, it looked like we might be getting an American version of Doctor Who. The TV movie starring Paul McGann and Eric Roberts sunglasses was poised to set the stage for a new era of Who, American style. Now, as we all know, that never happened, but AM Audio Media, who we've had many times on the old Who Wars podcast, often in relation to a fan audio they made called Dark Journey, has decided to take a really cheeky look at an alternate timeline where Doctor Who became very, very American, and they've called it Dark Odyssey. Now, Dark Odyssey, you might know some of these people, features Atway Atway, Paul Thomas Manns, Jason Gray, and Maren Lalonde. It's written by M.A. Tamburo, who's been on Who Wars in the past, as I've mentioned. Music's by Joshua Hamming, and the sound's been designed by Kevin Gray. You'll hear three more clips of a similar nature spread throughout this episode. I won't tell you where, so don't look at the show notes. They'll just appear. Basically, I think they're hilarious. I think the first time I played them, I just went, oh, this is sensational. I've got to use this on the show. And if you do want to hear more AM Audio Media stuff, just plug the name into the search engine on our website, thedwshow.net, and you'll find all sorts of stuff, including the Dark Journey special, where I spoke with the Doctor from Dark Journey, Andrew Chalmers, for a very funny and engaging 1 hour, 45 minutes, and it's really fun. Anyway, moving on, because I like keeping these intros short, and I think we're already running over now, congrats to Proctor Who on its 50th episode this week, and the Blue Box Podcast on its 200th episode also this week. What else? Oh yes, we've had some lovely feedback coming through on email and social and iTunes reviews, so we'll cover those at the end of the show. For right now, as we move into the interview slot of this episode, many of you will know J.R. Southall, either from his team captain role on the Blue Box podcast, his scribblings in Starburst magazine, or possibly as the singer-songwriter behind such hits as Flat Stanley Saved My Life. Well, he is now in the final stages of finishing up a book with a number of contributors called Hating to Love, which is basically reappraising the worst Doctor Who stories out there. And I thought it might be fun, you know, as publication comes closer. It's still not, you know, finalised yet, but it's coming closer. I thought it might be fun to give him a call and, you know, see what this book's all about. So strap yourselves in and let's see.
Hello?
Hey, JR, it's Rob Irwin here from the Doctor Who Show.
Sorry, say again.
JR, it's Rob Irwin here from the Doctor Who Show.
Is that some new kind of PIP thing? Are you trying to sell me something there?
No.
Hello, Rob.
Hello there. I'm well. I was just telling our listeners about a new book that's coming out called Hating to Love, and who better to tell us more about it than yourself?
Yeah, well, I suppose since it was my idea. well, after 5 years of doing the Ewan Who books, and I guess we'll probably talk a little bit about the Ewan Who books later on.
Oh, yes.
After 5 years of doing those, well, the first thing that came into my head was I kind of wanted to do a book on Doctor Who myself, mm-hmm. which would take some of the things I talk about in the Blue Box podcast and try and do a sort of history of the programme, sort of skewed through the angles that I look at it through. You know, when you buy guides to Doctor Who, they're all pretty much the same sort of thing, aren't they?
The
classics will get talked about a lot, and they'll say these are the classics. And the ones that aren't so good will tend to, you know, you'll get slightly funnier essays about those, taking the mickey out of them a bit, or saying these are a bit rubbish. But they don't generally tend to go into the reasons why.
Mm.
And one of the things that fascinates me about that is, well, going back to Caves of Androzani and the Twin Dilemma, and do you remember at the time John Nathan Turner sort of sent Eric Saward off to do Caves of Androzani by himself and said, oh, and I'm doing the Twin Dilemma. And I think he famously told something like Doctor Who magazine, oh, Caves of Androzani is probably going to be good, but the Twin Dilemma is going to be excellent. It's going to be one of the best Doctor Who stories ever. Mm-hmm. And of course, it turned out not to be. And one of the things that's always fascinated me about that is those two stories were made right next to each other. And there's no real reason. I mean, they always say things like, oh, you run out of budget by the time you do the last story in a season. Well, that doesn't necessarily have to be the case if you've put enough budget to the side.
Mm.
So you can't give that as an excuse for a story not doing very well. There has to be something more fundamental than that. I mean, Time Flight looks quite cheap, but then it's got all that stuff with Concord. So it's not as if it is the cheapest story in that season. Kinder, for example, was a lot cheaper than Time Flight, I should imagine. So I wanted to look at the more fundamental reasons why the stories that didn't do well didn't do well. Mm. And I wanted to do a sort of history of the programme through looking at the stories that didn't do so well. I thought that would be a more interesting angle. And you could still talk about the ones that do well, but you would talk about them through the sort of fulcrum of the ones that failed.
Now, how did you end up picking these stories? Did you go by ratings or did you go by just fan opinion, Doctor Who magazine polls? How did you pick them?
Well, originally when I was going to do this entirely by myself, because the original idea I had was I was going to do it entirely by myself. But because of the Ewan Who books and how much time they take up, that became impossible. So then I thought I'll do it in a similar sort of way to Ewan Who. When I was going to do it entirely by myself, what I thought initially was I'd take the latest Doctor Who magazine poll, and because I wanted to make it a history of the entire series, I didn't want to leave any season untouched. I was going to take the story that came bottom in each season and write the sort of history of that season through the prism of that story. But when I decided then afterwards that it was going to have to be written by a bunch of people, and in the end there were 10 of us altogether who've each written, you know, 5 or 6 essays each.
Mm-hmm.
So what we did then was, one afternoon, we all got together on Facebook in a sort of private resource we had for the book. And what we went through, what we did is we went through the seasons one by one and said, right, this is the obvious story for this season. But alternatively, we could end up writing about this one or this one, because for various different reasons, the story that comes bottom isn't necessarily always the one that you could describe as the worst of that season, if you know what I mean. Sometimes the one that comes bottom is bottom because it's not popular, but not necessarily because it's the worst. So we went through, because I should say, for anybody who doesn't realize, Hating to Love, the sort of tagline underneath is reappraising the 52 worst Doctor Who stories of all time.
That's it.
Which is a huge fat lie for many different reasons. But I thought it was a good tagline, so that's what we're going with. So then we sort of went through season by season and picked out one story, or sometimes two, because obviously there are far fewer than 52 seasons. So some seasons, especially the longer ones, the ones with more stories, we've covered by talking about two stories instead of just the one.
Right.
And picked out the ones that we thought would be more interesting to talk about, using that as the kind of definition for what we wanted to say. So we picked out stories. One of the stories we've picked out, for example, is Turn Left.
Okay.
Which is probably actually one of the more popular stories in that season, probably top two or three. But by the same token, it's probably also one of the more problematic stories in that season. In other words, for various different reasons, I think Turn Left doesn't necessarily stand up as a good Doctor Who story.
Right, yes, I heard your thoughts on a recent Blue Box podcast.
It
made me think, because I've always just watched and thought, oh, I really enjoyed that, you know, and when I think of that season or series, I think, oh, I always seem to forget about that story, and when I watch it, I'm always delighted by it. And then when I heard you talk about it, I thought, oh, yeah, maybe it's not all it's cracked up to be.
Yeah, it's not that it's not good. And I, in the same podcast, actually, I talked about Midnight as well, didn't I?
That's right.
And I think they're both great sort of episodes of TV, but not necessarily great episodes of Doctor Who. And in fact, it wasn't my choice to put Turn Left in the book. It was somebody else's choice, John Davies, and he's writing about it.
Right.
So you'll find out why when you read the book. But but I'm just giving you that as an example of some of the story. I wanted to put Genesis of the Daleks in.
Oh, now that would be controversial.
Yeah, it would. But it's a case of, it's a story that I don't think is necessarily what it gets painted as. It's painted as the classic Dalek story, and I don't think it's by any stretch of the imagination the classic Dalek story. It's the classic Davros story, but that's a different thing entirely.
Mm.
So I thought there was a case for putting Genesis of the Daleks in there, but in the end, nobody would take it.
Now, you mentioned one of the contributors a moment ago. Who are the other contributors who have put this book together with you?
Well, there's 10 of us all together. Right, I'm going to have to do this by memory, so I'm hoping I don't forget any names. But the first two that went into the hat were Christopher Bryant and John Davies, because they've both edited other books for Watching Books.
Mm-hmm.
And John Arnold is also in there, and he's currently doing the Bowie book for us.
Ah, okay. That is going ahead, is it?
Yeah, so that'll come out later this year. So other than John Arnold, we've also got Al Noe.
Yes, know him well.
Yeah, and his essays are always fascinating, and they're also always very, very idiosyncratic.
Yes.
And I wanted to see, because I thought there was room in this book for a bit of experimentation with the authors, so I thought if I get Al Noe in and try and get him to write the kind of essay he doesn't normally write, then he might come up with something even more interesting than what he usually does.
Okay.
So Al Noe's in there. Beth Ward's in there.
Yes.
Got Brendan Jones from Flight Through Entirety, because I mean, you must have heard that podcast.
Oh, of course, yeah.
And in Brendan Jones, I kind of, you know, listening to Flight Through Entirety, I kind of thought he's a bit of a kindred spirit. So, and he'd written for You and Who, so I thought, let's have him. And then there's a bunch of authors who had always been really good with You and Who, dropping in essays at the last minute when something else fell through, you know, basically stepping up and helping out. So I've got people like Nicholas Hollins and Michael Collins, and they've always written great things for You and Who, so it was good to have them on too. Just trying to think now if there's anybody I've forgotten. I don't think so. I think that's all 10 of us. Oh, Tony Green. Tony Green, his essays for You and Who were always spectacular.
Yeah.
I mean, he's the kind of a writer who gives a real personal angle on something, but also covers all the bases at the same time. So he says all the things you want him to say, but he says it in such a way that he absolutely paints a picture of what he's thinking. And his essays in this are great. In fact, all the essays in this are great, although I'm still waiting for a few, so this book isn't going to be out quite as soon as I was hoping it would be, but, you know, it's ready when it's ready, and it should be ready in the next few weeks, with fingers crossed.
So maybe by the time this podcast is going out, actually.
With a bit of luck, although I suspect it's probably more likely to be late April, I would say, probably.
Okay, no problem. Yeah. Well, we were talking about some of the submissions a moment ago. Was there a piece in the book that really surprised you when it came in, and why?
Oh, grief. Do you know, Beth Ward's, her essays, all of them have surprised me in a way. And she's still got a couple to submit, but one of them, the one on Meglos, I think is a bit surprising.
Can you say why without giving anything away?
Only insofar as she looks at things through a complete, you know, from a completely different angle from the one you'd expect. So her essay on Meglos has got nothing really to do with the cheapness of it, and nothing really, from what I've seen of it, because she hasn't actually submitted it yet. She just sent me a sort of first draft. But it doesn't look at Meglos in any of the ways that you might expect it to. If you just look at Meglos and say, oh, it's a cheap one and it doesn't really fit in with the rest of that season, she actually goes in depth into how stories work. So her essays, she's got another one on The Curse of the Black Spot that basically gives it a bit of a kicking.
Well, there's a story I think should be in the book, personally.
Well, do you know what, though? I like it.
Really?
Yeah, I don't dislike it at all. But she always looks at things from an angle of, does the story work on a sort of fundamental level, mm-hmm. rather than just, does it look cheap and nasty? Which I think is the problem with, you know, a lot of the Doctor Who stories that kind of end up at the bottom of these piles. Something like Warriors of the Deep, as a story, as a script, it kind of works.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's just how it looks on screen that kind of does for it, really.
Yeah, exactly.
And so there's quite a few essays that, you know, bring up that kind of thing. But what I tried to tell the authors to do was, instead of just taking one of the stories that's ended up at the bottom of the polls and, you know, has always gone down in sort of fan history as a story that doesn't work, I said to them, look, try and forget all the usual things, the fact that the budget wasn't up to the job, it was more ambitious than the budget could cope with, and try and examine the story, you know, in terms of it being a story rather than it being an episode of a television series that doesn't have enough money to cover all the special effects it should have had. I tried to get them to look at these things on a more fundamental level. And one of the big things going into this book, like I say, when I first had the idea, which must have been over a year ago, I think, it was going to be all about the context.
Yeah.
So something like The Twin Dilemma, the essay was going to be more about the context of how the story was made and how the other stories around it were made and what it was in The Twin Dilemma that went wrong, that didn't go wrong in those other stories, that made The Twin Dilemma the one that sticks out as not working very well. So I asked everybody with their essays, instead of just writing about the story, to actually write about the people making the story, where it fits in the season, the other stories that were being made around it, in order to give some context to how or why that story has a reputation.
I was going to say that Twin Dilemma example would be quite unique, because you'd be largely talking about a whole different Doctor for some of it, if you're talking about the stories around it or the season it's made in.
Yeah, but also what comes afterwards sometimes, although not necessarily. But yeah, in the season. And actually, you know, not everybody's taking this on board, so all of the essays aren't quite like this. And the other thing was, I said to everybody, it's fine if you look at the story and say it is bad. Mm. You know, on a sort of a fairly objective level, it doesn't work. I said it's fine if you reappraise the story and find it still doesn't work. This doesn't have to be a book with a bunch of essays in saying, actually, this story's better than you think it is. Although it's kind of mostly turned into a book which says all these stories are better than you think they are. But then, you know, in a funny way, that's a good book to have, because it could send people back to their DVDs, these 50-odd stories, to take a second look and to think to themselves, okay, yeah, I can see what they were talking about. I can see what the people making this episode, this story, were going for, and I can see where it fails, but that doesn't necessarily mean that it's failed on every level. Sometimes these stories just fail on one level, and they're working on all sorts of other levels.
Well, I think that's a nice segue into... You mentioned that Beth's piece does give Curse of the Black Spot a kicking, so it sounds like it does conclude that it's bad. You don't think that it's bad. You said there's a conversation to be had here. Why don't we go down that path for a moment?
Oh, well, I was just going to say... Well, it's kind of what I've just been saying. You know, I said to Beth, like I said to everybody else, if you find that, you know, you reappraise something and you think it has fundamental problems, say so. And I think her last... I'm not giving too much away by saying this. I think her last paragraph on The Curse of the Black Spot, after she spent about 15 paragraphs giving it a bit of a kicking, says, and actually, on a simple entertainment level, it kind of works, as long as you ignore everything else that's wrong with it. And, you know, that I think that's the case. Because, like I say, I actually find that story absolutely fine. I can see that it has certain problems. But this goes back to what I was saying about me not looking at the program through a fan's eyes. You know, my earliest memory is Planet of the Daleks. And other than a few speeches at the end from John Pertwee about what it means to be brave, Planet of the Daleks doesn't really say anything. It's not like a Malcolm Hulk story that has a lot to say about politics and social politics. It's a story that is just there to be an adventure. And I think growing up with, you know, the Target books, and my favorites of the Target books were Planet of the Daleks and Death to the Daleks and things like that, and the Robert Holmes Orton stories. Growing up with those stories, I was always happy for Doctor Who not to have something to say, just to entertain for 4 episodes or 6 episodes. And I think as a grown-up, you tend to look at Doctor Who and you tend to think that if it's not saying something, it's failing.
Yeah, that's a good point, yeah.
And I think one of the things that this book addresses is that, you know, it's fine for stories just to be there to entertain for a few episodes, for a few weeks. You know, as long as you don't go for whole stretches of the series where it has absolutely nothing to say at all. Mind you, even saying that, if you look at the sort of Philip Hinchcliffe, Robert Holmes era, you've got 3 seasons that don't really say anything at all, and they're regarded as the best 3 seasons the series has ever had.
Very true.
So what can you say? You know, one man's meat is another man's potatoes. It's all swings and roundabouts, and there's me mixing metaphors. But, you know, it's what you take out of it. It's always been the case that, as a grown-up, because as a kid, you're quite happy to accept a lot of things. I think as a grown-up, you end up looking for certain things.
I think
so. And sometimes those things are to have episodes that mean something. And sometimes it's to have an episode that works on an emotional level, especially these days in the new series, that works on a character level. Sometimes it's to have a story that, while it doesn't necessarily mean something in the sort of wider political sense or whatever, sometimes it's to have a story that works on different layers, where those layers tie together, where you feel kind of a sense of satisfaction at the end. I think that's where Curse of the Black Spot doesn't really work. I don't think it satisfies at the end. I find it very entertaining, but it's not entirely satisfying, and I think that's what Beth gets at in the essay.
Okay. Well, we were talking about pieces that surprised you, and speaking of surprised, do any of the episodes in the book surprise you because you think, oh, hang on, I quite like that one? You know, when you were sitting down with the group, did one come up and you maybe fighting against it, perhaps, from being in the book?
Well, on the subject of that, there may be a secret chapter at the end of the book. Where we actually, each of us, not necessarily all of us, actually, because I think this is down to who's got time to join in and do it, and who's actually got the wherewithal to join in and do it. But this won't be in the contents page, but there is going to be a chapter at the end of the book where each one of us picks a classic story and looks at it from the opposite angle and says, is a classic story a classic because it's fundamentally, objectively better? Or is it just because where it sits in the series, it sticks out? Caves of Androzani, for instance. I mean, this is my own personal opinion, but I don't think Caves of Androzani is a particularly good Doctor Who story. I think it's a great piece of television, but I think as a piece of Doctor Who, it doesn't really work. But I think because it's head and shoulders above everything else, you know, in the period of across about maybe 5 years,
mm-hmm.
I think it has a reputation that outstrips its actual value. So Caves of Androzani's in there. Not me writing about that one, funnily enough. But what we're doing is we're going to ask the question, does this story really deserve its reputation? And then look at the story and try and answer that.
Okay. And earlier you mentioned, you know, perhaps you would have liked to have seen Genesis of the Daleks in there. I mean, that...
is that when I said it's not in there, it's not on the contents page, but it is going to be in the secret chapter.
Ooh, that's an exclusive, folks.
Yeah.
Just getting back to the main question, though, I'm putting aside the secret chapter. Is there anything that, you know, got in and you thought, oh, I wish it hadn't because I like it?
There are lots of ones in there because of the way we did it, where we said we're going to have a story from every season. And sometimes the story that we pick is going to be the one that sticks out like a sore thumb. Well, not even like a sore thumb, just the one that sticks out a bit rather than the one that's bad necessarily. So there are things in there like the Three Doctors and the Deadly Assassin, which, like Turn Left, we've picked for the book, not because they have necessarily a bad reputation, but because they're so different from what's around them that writing about them kind of illustrates something about what's around them.
Right, okay.
If you know what I mean.
Yeah.
So some of the essays attack things from those angles. And then there are other seasons where there isn't a bad story. Do you know what I mean? Season 7, for example. Obviously, we had to. If we were going to do a story from every season, we had to do a story from season 7, and patently out of those four stories, it was going to be the Ambassadors of Death. So the Ambassadors of Death's in there, but I mean, nobody's going to argue that the Ambassadors of Death isn't a good story. But hopefully, the essay on Ambassadors of Death sort of addresses why, in some ways, that one doesn't do quite as well as the other three stories in that season. And, you know, there are a bunch of essays like that which have picked a story out that's not necessarily a bad story, but that just doesn't quite work as well as what's around it.
Okay, that's very interesting. It's leading me to wonder what you might have written for the book. What stories have you tackled, can you say?
Oh, I'll tell you my six, if you like.
Please.
If I can remember them off the top of my head. Well, one of them is The Enemy of the World.
Okay.
Well, the way it worked when we were choosing, what we did was, first of all of us sat and went through the stories and picked one, which ones we would cover. And then the following day, we went back in and, you know, the way I did it was I got everybody to email me their choices in secret. And then I allocated backwards, trying to make sure everybody got what they wanted.
Right.
Because there were some stories where three people would put their name down for it.
Yeah.
But I made sure everybody in the book was writing about things they wanted to write about and nobody got stuck with something they didn't.
Mm-hmm.
So although some people didn't necessarily get their first choice, if they didn't get their first choice, they got their second, third, fourth and fifth. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
So I ended up being the editor of the book. I kind of put myself aside from that process and said, I said to myself, look, originally you were going to do this whole thing, so you're going to write about everything, so it doesn't really matter what you end up with.
Exactly. Yeah.
So, yeah, well, so I've ended up writing about a few things that I wouldn't have chosen because they're things that I've written about already.
Right, okay.
So The Enemy of the World, I did quite a lengthy review of that when it came back on, you know, in 2013, and I've ended up writing about that again. So I've ended up writing about not the story, but I've ended up writing entirely about its reputation.
Yeah, I was going to say that's probably the angle there, isn't it? Because it was missing for so long and it built up this reputation as being a thing. And then when you
there was complete indifference towards it pretty much before it came back. And since it came back, everybody, you know, seems to have jumped on the, oh, this was a lost classic sort of bandwagon. Whereas I think the truth is somewhere in between. I think it's always been a fascinating story because of the two Troughtons thing. It was always the story I most wanted to see of all the ones that were missing. It was always top of my list because of the two Troughtons. But by the same token, although it's fascinating for that, I think the story itself ain't really all that great shakes. You know, especially when you get into the last two episodes and there's this, you know, very James Bond secret base underground. And, you know, it transpires what's been going on. I don't think it really adds up all that well. So I think, although it's a very good story, it's certainly not a classic. So I think the way its reputation has gone from one extreme to the other is quite a fascinating topic for an essay by itself.
Yeah, I was going to say part of that reputation is not just the story, but I think Troughton himself.
Yes.
He's always been relatively popular as a doctor, but it seems in the last decade or two, he's become the governor, he's become the doctor for a lot of people when it comes to the classic era. And I can't remember it being that way back in the 80s when I first got into fandom. As I say, he was always popular, but not to the degree he is today.
I wonder if that's because during the 90s, during the 80s, you only had, gosh, was it four complete, might even have been three complete stories. So by the end of the decade, when things were coming out on video and things were being shown on the satellite television channels over here, and of course in America and Australia, you wouldn't show a story that wasn't complete. So I think people only had about three stories to go on.
Yeah, it wasn't many.
So I think as you get into the 90s and more of his episodes start coming back, I think that's perhaps when people start to say, oh, hang on, look at what's going on here with this chap. And to be honest, you look at The Enemy of the World and you look at his performance and you think that is as astonishing, in fact, more so than his performances in any of his other stories would be if we had those back. But you know what, other than the fact that he's also playing Salamander, I think any of his other stories that were to come back, you'd see him giving just as good a performance. If all of his stories had always existed, the performance that he gives across his entire tenure would basically be more or less on a level. You'd love it from start to finish. I think the reason why The Enemy of the World is currently so vaunted is because it's the most recent. So it's the one where actually being able to watch his performance is at its freshest.
Yeah.
So I think his performance in that gets elevated in people's minds above all those other stories, even though in all those other stories he gives just as good a performance. And obviously you also have the Salamander thing as well, which, like I say, is the reason why that was always top of my list for ones I wanted to see come back. But beyond the Salamander thing, he is just that good an actor, and I'm sure he is that good an actor in, you know, whatever it might be, whether it's the Space Pirates or whether it's Fury from the Deep. And when we got the second episode of The Underwater Menace back, you know, it's exactly the same thing. That story got reappraised because all of a sudden you had an extra 25 minutes of Patrick Troughton to look at.
Exactly. All right, your second piece in the book.
Planet of the Daleks. Again, I've written about this before. It was, like I say, my earliest proper Doctor Who memory.
Yeah.
You know, one of the things that's always said about that is that it's basically a remake of the Daleks. I don't think actually it's a remake so much as it takes some of the elements and plays a new game with them.
Right, yeah.
But by the same token, even if it was a remake, I wouldn't have a problem with that either. Especially given the context. Like I say, a lot of this book is all about the context. When Planet of the Daleks came on the telly, Daleks hadn't been seen on telly for 10 years. And the novelization of the Daleks had been out of print for 8 years. And the film of the Daleks had been and gone in the cinemas, you know, 8 or 9 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
So by the time Planet of the Daleks came on, any 8-year-olds or 6-year-olds or even 10-year-olds who were watching it probably wouldn't know the original Dalek story at all, let alone well enough to be able to point at Planet of the Daleks and say, oh, you know, that's a bit of a remake. So from that perspective,
I was going to say the original viewers had come and gone, the ones who were kids back watching the original, and exactly.
So I think from that perspective, much like with the new Star Wars film, I've not seen it yet, but I keep hearing that either it's a remake or else it takes the same elements as the original. And I keep thinking to myself, that's fine, because, you know, the 10-year-olds are going to see that in the cinema now. Although they might know the other Star Wars films from having seen them on the telly, to go to the cinema and see the new Star Wars film is going to be an entirely different experience for them, so let them have it.
Oh, yeah, and even for me, as a, you know, just to go off on a tangent, you know, I'm a big Star Wars fan, have been since I was a kid. It still didn't even bother me, you know? The fact that there's a droid and he's carrying a secret message, and you know,
stuff like that. Yeah.
Oh yeah. There's a lot of stuff that's the same as Star Wars, but it's done in a different way, and it's on different planets, and it has different characters, and you know, it's just the same story repeating, which is a theme in literature, I guess.
I was going to say, you know, when people point at things and say, "Oh, that's a remake," when you know, this happens with Stephen Moffat all the time. They say, "Oh, he's reusing something," and I'm like, he's a writer. writers have themes in their work. And if he's reusing something, that's not because he's run out of inspiration, but that's because that's something that interests him, that he likes to come back to.
Yeah, that's right.
You know, that's how it works. In Star Wars, you know, two of the three original Star Wars films have got lengthy sequences where somebody's being educated in the ways of being a Jedi.
Yes.
Not necessarily so much in the first one, but, you know, that's part of the plot when Luke Skywalker finds Obi-Wan Kenobi in the first one, isn't it? Obi-Wan is supposed to teach him in the ways of being a Jedi.
That's right.
And then Yoda takes that over in the second movie. The first and the third movies both end up with big, great big Death Stars and a big sequence where they try to blow it up. These are just the themes of the films.
And the new film has its own Death Star-like thing in it.
Yeah. At that, again, that's a theme of Star Wars. It wouldn't be a Star Wars movie if it didn't have stuff from the original Star Wars movies. That's the universe that Star Wars takes place in. Those are the things that happen.
Well, coming back to Planet of the Daleks and its context, did you cover the Target novel at all in what you were saying?
Not really, because although that was the very first Target novel I ever bought, I don't think it's actually a very good one. But I'll tell you what my other angle on Planet of the Daleks was, which I'm not sure if I've spoken about before. I may have. 2 years after Planet of the Daleks, Barry Letts famously said to Terry Nation, "You've written this story for us twice already. Can you find some new way of doing it?" And Terry Nation gave them Davros. And the thing that people always remember about Davros in the in Genesis of the Daleks is all the speeches. If you look at Planet of the Daleks, it has just as many speeches that are pretty much as good, but on a very slightly different subject. You know, the sort of speeches that John Pertwee gives about bravery and such.
Yeah.
It's not a million miles away from what he's doing with Davros in Genesis, other than the fact that it is Davros in Genesis, so he can talk about the Daleks being born as opposed to what the Daleks have become, which is what they're talking about in Planet of the Daleks. It strikes me that those are two different sides of the same coin, and there's not really that much to split between them. They both even share a director, and you know, some of the stuff that David Maloney does in Planet of the Daleks is pretty good, considering that it's basically a gigantic alien planet that's all jungle done in a tiny little TV studio. So part of my angle on Planet of the Daleks is this actually that much worse than Genesis of the Daleks, or do the two stories share rather a lot more than fandom would seem to think?
Interesting. All right, number three.
Delta and the Bannermen.
Ooh. Now, there's one I'm not fond of.
I get that reaction so many times, and I sort of understand it, but I think Delta and the Bannermen is an absolutely lovely story. This is Andrew Cartmell's first series in Doctor Who. He's only doing three stories in this series, and although he has an idea about what he wants to do, you know, famously the graphic novel thing, he doesn't yet quite know how that's going to translate into the series itself. So if you look at Paradise Towers, Delta and the Bannermen, and Dragonfire, what you basically have is three different pilots for what Doctor Who will become. And if you look at the second series, you've got Remembrance, which is kind of more in the Dragonfire ilk.
Yeah.
And you have Happiness Patrol and Greatest Show, which are more in the Paradise Towers ilk.
Mm-hmm.
And you have Silver Nemesis, which is kind of more like Dragonfire, but has shades of Delta and the Bannermen. And then if you go to the third series, Battlefield through to Survival, he's pretty much settled on the sort of Dragonfire template.
Yeah, yeah.
So the sort of left field, sort of, what was the word that they used for those? The slightly oddball ones, the oddball stories.
Yeah.
By the time you get to season 26, the oddball ones have pretty much gone out the window. But Delta and the Bannermen, I don't think is either oddball or sort of neo-traditional. I think Delta and the Bannermen is something else entirely. I think it's a really lyrical way of looking at Doctor Who. It's like how can I put this? It's kind of it's almost like a rustic Doctor Who story. It's almost like what Doctor Who would be if you took all the tech out of it. There's two aliens chasing each other on planet Earth, just like you had in, say, the 11th Hour, for example, where you've got, you know, the eye in the sky chasing after the snake thing that hangs down from the ceiling.
Mm-hmm.
Whatever. There's been a bunch of stories like that. Delta and the Bannermen, you've got that, but that is so far in the background. It's got all this other stuff on top. It seems to be saying to me, let's take the idea for a Doctor Who story and let's build something entirely different out of those building blocks. And I think what it comes up with is kind of lovely in the way that things like Dad's Army are lovely. Okay. I think Delta and the Bannermen is the Dad's Army of Doctor Who. Because Dad's Army, essentially, if you were to say to somebody who'd never seen it, this is what this series is about, they'd think, oh, it's a war story. But actually, you watch Dad's Army, and it's not a war story at all. The war is so deep in the background of Dad's Army that there are some episodes of Dad's Army where you don't even think to yourself, oh, this is taking place during the war. It's about the characters. It's about the situations they get into. It's about, you know, the silly things that happen. Delta and the Bannermen is a Doctor Who story where the Doctor Who is so far in the background. It's about the characters. It's about the situations and the silly things that happen. I think it's a lovely story. I think it sits apart from Doctor Who. So maybe it's not a very good Doctor Who story, which is why, obviously, it's in this book. But I think if you can look at it through unjaded eyes and just accept it for what it's doing, I think it's almost poetical in the way it looks at Doctor Who and says, right, this is what Doctor Who can do, rather than this being what Doctor Who should do.
Very interesting. I think that'll be an interesting essay to read.
Yeah, hopefully.
I think we're up to number four.
The TV movie. I've done the TV movie.
Okay.
Again, this is one that I've written about before, so I didn't necessarily want to, but, you know, it was one of the ones I was left with, so I was quite happy to do it. Look, the TV movie was supposed to reinvent Doctor Who for an entirely brand new audience who never heard of Doctor Who before.
Yes.
You know, as much as there were Doctor Who fans in America prior to the TV movie, this wasn't aimed at them. This was aimed at the people who'd never heard of Doctor Who. And yet
it starts with, I'm a Time Lord and my enemy's the Master, exactly. And I've been to Skaro and I'm on this regeneration. It's like, what?
My contention with the TV movie is that if you strip out everything up to the moment where the TARDIS lands in the middle of a sort of gangland heist sequence, a robbery, whatever it is, if you strip out everything that happens before then, you understand what's going on just as well as you would have done if you had all the explanations at the start, but you've taken out of it everything that would put off an audience who'd never seen the series before.
Yeah,
I think if you watch those first 5 minutes and you've never heard of Doctor Who, it's lost you and you don't care. I think if you start that movie, that TV movie, with, you know, a sort of gangland sort of robbery taking place, a street robbery taking place, and all of a sudden this big blue box appears out of nowhere, and then this guy steps out of it and they shoot him, and instead of dying, he turns into somebody else. I think you've got your casual audience absolutely hooked, wanting to find out what's going on. Instead, you have this ridiculously stupid sequence at the start of the film where there's a guy sitting in this great big cathedral-type space that you don't even know is supposed to be inside this blue box, telling you what's going on.
Yeah.
It makes no sense.
Yeah, because I think what you're suggesting is more show, don't tell, which I would agree with as well.
Yeah, and I think the TV movie, actually, in spite of the fact that everybody says it tells rather than showing, I think after those first 5 minutes, it does a grand job of showing rather than telling. It's just that those 5 minutes have told you everything it's going to show you before it actually does.
I was going to say, did it happen to cover McGann's wig at all?
No. No, there were the essays in this book could have been 10,000 words each if you were going to go into everything. So I think each one of them basically chooses an angle and runs with that angle for a couple of thousand words. So, yeah. So that's my angle on the TV movie. And my basic contention with that is drop the first 5 minutes and actually it's a really good piece of television.
That's right. Which I think brings us to number five.
Which is The Time of the Doctor, which again is something that I've written about. But again, that was something I was kind of left with. And, you know, I think Time of the Doctor, much like what I said about Delta and the Bannermen, I think Time of the Doctor works almost, you know, against the rest of Doctor Who, works almost the same way as a poem works against a prose. I think it's an entirely different thing that people weren't expecting. And I think the reason why it has a bad reputation is because it's not what people were expecting, rather than because it's not very good. I think The Time of the Doctor is actually a wonderful piece of Doctor Who. I think it's just that people were expecting the 11th Doctor to have an explosive climax, but he'd already had his explosive climax in the Day of the Doctor, and this is kind of the lyrical epilogue to his period as the Doctor instead, and that's not what people were expecting. Do you know what? When Russell T. Davies did The End of Time, he talked about doing a quiet story where the Doctor, instead of saving the entire universe, just saves some people on a spaceship or a single planet or whatever. And he's just involved with a very few people, and it's a very quiet story, and he just saves a very few people, and at the end of it, it's that small thing, that small sacrifice he makes that causes him to change.
That's right. It was going to be a family who had broken down in a car or something. Like
a space car, perhaps. Exactly.
And he got radiation poisoning from the engine. I'm vaguely remembering that.
And then, in the end, he decided to do the most over-the-top Doctor Who story ever, because it was Tennant's last. And you know what? People bemoaned the fact that he hadn't done that, because that would, in a way, have reminded them of the Caves of Androzani, where it's a small sacrifice rather than saving the entire universe that causes the regeneration.
Yeah.
Time of the Doctor is essentially the story that everybody wanted when they got the End of Time. Mm. It's a small story with the Doctor saving a small town on a small planet, and it's not the universe that's at stake, it's just, you know, a few people in this tiny little community, and you don't get to meet many of them. You don't get, you know, because it's Stephen Moffat doing a, you know, one of his end of season type things. It's not end of season, but you know what I mean. He's when he does his finales, he tends to throw in cameos for a bunch of monsters, because he'll tend to be telling a more intimate story. And I think he feels that in order that the kids, you know, the 6-year-olds and the 8-year-olds are satisfied, so we'll throw in Sontarans and a Daleks and, you know, a Cyberman, wooden Cyberman. That kind of says it all about this story. The Cyberman turns up and it's made of wood. Mm. And isn't that stupid and wonderful and unexpected and delightful and just beautifully inappropriate? And that's what the story is. It's stupid and wonderful, delightful, inappropriate, and just lyrical and gorgeous. I think Time of the Doctor is a gorgeous story, but I don't think it's what people expected, and I think that's why it has a reputation that fails to live up to what the story's real value truly is.
Yeah, I think so. All right, moving on to the last one now.
Yeah, the last one, I was only going to do 5 because I'd also done the introduction, which is just the same length as all the other essays. But then, because this book's taken slightly longer than we intended, this book was going to come out last autumn, but You and Who Else turned into such a huge book that in the end, this had to get put off for a few months while I, A, finished that other one, and B, recovered. So this has come out a bit later than intended. So actually, it suddenly struck me we should add in a story from Series 9. So I'll let you guess which story I picked from Series 9 to write about.
From Series 9? A story people disliked from Series 9? This is hard, because I quite liked a lot of Series 9. I liked a lot of Series 9 better than Series 8.
Yeah.
But there's one
that sticks out.
Oh, if I had to guess, it's one of the Ashilda stories, perhaps?
No, it's Sleep No More.
Oh, of course. Of course.
Yeah. So bad you'd forgotten it was even there.
I know, because that's the one that I don't like in the series, and I had forgotten about it, actually.
Yeah. And I felt exactly the same way. So I spend 8 pages going over everything Mark Gatiss has written for Doctor Who, saying, how did he come to the point where he wrote something like Sleep No More? And how did it come to the point where something like Sleep No More is stuck in the middle of a series that otherwise is entirely consistent all the way through? And so that's my angle on Sleep No More.
Well, very interesting. Now, all along, we've been talking about You and Who. It's been peppered all through this conversation, but we haven't really gotten into it. Now, I'll just say up front, you know, for reasons of a full disclaimer, I am in the first You and Who book. I'm in You and Who Contact Has Been Made, both volumes, and I am in You and Who Else. So I have written for these books.
Oh, yes.
So I am fond of the concept.
And you were on my shortlist for this book, except the shortlist was about 50 names long.
I bet it was, because there are a lot of people involved in the You and Who books.
It's kind of become, not a family business and not a cottage industry, but you know what? There are a lot of regular people who love the concept so much they can keep coming back to it time after time.
That's
and
right.
Some people fall away and some new people come. So you always have a turnover of people, but with a lot of regular names.
Now, that concept for the people at home, well, would you like to tell us about it? Maybe how it came to be?
Yeah. Well, I tell you what, I'll try and give you the concept in a sentence. These are books about, not necessarily always Doctor Who, because obviously I've done one just on British telefantasy in general, and there's one on Blake Seven, and there are going to be others, one on David Bowie. The concept is kind of, you write about the thing that you've watched, but rather than writing about the thing that you've watched, you write about watching it. So it's an autobiographical description of the place you were in when you watched it than it is about the actual thing that you watched. It's not a review of the episode or the series or the book or the concert or the record or whatever. It's not a review. It's a sort of description of what you were doing and what things were going on in your life that made you connect with whatever it is that's the subject of your essay in such a way that it's become so important to you. So if you're writing about, for instance, you know, a particular Doctor Who story, you won't be saying, oh, I like this Doctor Who story because it's really good. You wouldn't necessarily pick one that was really good, but you might pick one because it was the first one you saw. And that's a really obvious way to go about it. But a lot of people have picked ones that were important to them for other reasons. There's one of the essays in Contact Has Been Made where somebody talks about his video collection, and this chap sort of fell upon hard times, and the one thing that became a sort of touchstone for him was his VHS collection that was in the basement at his parents' house. And when he was going through all sorts of struggles and troubles, he keeps talking about coming back and sort of paying a visit on his parents. And, you know, the thing that would keep him happy is being able to go down to the basement and see that VHS collection and just pull a story out and stick it in the video machine and watch the story and forget about all his troubles for a couple of hours. And so he writes an essay about the story that he remembers pulling out and sticking on the video player. That's what these essays are really about. They're about the people rather than the stories.
Yeah, and that's what fascinated me about the concept, because reviews are a dime a dozen. You know, we've also had stuff like the discontinuity guide that Paul Cornell did in the 90s with some other blokes, which sort of took it in a slightly different direction and covered things like, you know, fluffs that might be made in episodes and you know, bits of continuity and so on. And that's fun too, but that's been done as well. This is something completely new and different, and you get to sort of know people and hear a little bit of their life, a little slice of their life in these stories.
Exactly, yeah. I mean, yes, everything else that's ever been written about the series has been already written. There's nothing new, really, to write about the series. And although when I write, a review or anything, I try and find an angle that I don't think's been done before. Undoubtedly, it's just that I've never read it before. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So when I came to doing the You and Who books, the inspiration for them, because this was before I was writing for Starburst magazine, Do you buy Doctor Who magazine?
I do, yeah.
Do you remember the specials that were doing the catching up, the special editions that were doing the catching up on the old archives?
Yes.
Where the additional information. And because it was just essentially information in those magazines, what they also did was got a bunch of people who'd written for the novels and for Big Finish and occasionally for the telly to write short essays about each of the stories so that there was something in there that wasn't just information and facts.
Yeah, something new.
And those essays were basically the professionals writing the same sort of thing that's turned up in You and Who. They were writing short personal histories about the programme. And it struck me what Doctor Who magazine should have done next is do a whole special entirely of people writing personal histories of the programme. But instead of it being professional people, to get the readers of the magazine to submit essays. And I emailed the magazine themselves and suggested it and never heard back, probably because it would have been such hard work to get done.
Yeah.
So instead, I just turned around and said, right, I'll do it myself.
And when you did it yourself initially, it was with a publisher, yes?
Yeah. Well, there's a bit of a story there. I went on the forums and said, look, I've had this idea for this book. and this is basically what it covers. And I'd also bought Desperately Seeking Susan Foreman. Do you remember? Which had been self-published.
I do, yes.
And I thought, well, if this is what the modern day can achieve, where you can self-publish, and although it doesn't look quite as good as a book that's published by a proper publisher, it's not so far off that it really makes a big difference. I thought I'll just self-publish. So I put out on, you know, various forums, this is my idea, this is what I want to do, and I was thinking I'll self-publish. And within a day, I had an essay from Stuart Humphreys, also known as Babel Colour, who had obviously connected with the idea so much that he just sat down that very afternoon and written the essay. And I also had an offer from Hearst. He hadn't offered quite to publish it straight away, because obviously I don't think he wanted to put his money where his mouth was until he'd read it, but basically offered to help with publishing it. As it transpired, because the guys at Milk had seen the post and said to Tim, who had been publishing their books at that time, this looks like a really good idea. You should see if you can get something to do with this. So when it all fell through with Hearst, Milk were the obvious ones to step in and say, look, we'll just publish it instead. Because, you know, it was those guys who'd noticed it in the first place. So Ewan Who and then Ewan Who Contact Has Been Made both came out with Milk. But then Milk, since those two books have come out, they've kind of changed what they're doing, rather. They're more into biographies and books from the professionals these days.
I think they also opened a shopfront as well.
Yeah, they've also opened a shop. So The thing about Milk is the Ewan Who books, much as I think they enjoyed having them, they don't really fit in with their profile anymore.
Mm.
And rather than try and find somebody else to do it, or rather than try and persuade Milk, no, this should be part of your profile, I just thought this is modern day now. Rather than having books that are going to go out of print when these, because we're talking small press publishing, we're talking, you know, not many hundreds of copies.
Yeah.
They're not going to print up 1,000 copies and have, you know, 700 copies sitting in a room somewhere waiting to be sold. And by the same token, if they print up 300 copies and they run out of 300 copies and they're selling maybe 3 a year, they're not going to print up another 100 to cope with the demand for 3 a year.
Exactly.
So when they go out of print, they're out of print, and that's it, the end of the story. And the three Ewan Who books, the two volumes of Contact and the original one, they'd all gone out of print. Mm. I just thought, modern day and age, you use a print-to-order service and you just publish them yourself.
Yeah.
And initially, Watching Books, because I formed this thing called Watching Books because I knew that if you went on an author's page on Amazon, you wouldn't necessarily be able to see all the Ewan Who books there. Because, for example, Christopher Bryant's name is on one of the volumes of Contact Has Been Made. So if you search for me, you wouldn't get Contact Has Been Made Volume 2.
Mm.
So I thought, right, you need a place to sort of centralize all this so people can find everything. So I created this thing. I called it Watching Books. And it's basically just a little website where you can go and you can find all these books. And so originally that was formed just to reprint the ones that already existed. But I already had an idea in mind for a third book that I wanted to do, which is Ewan Who Else? Because my own trajectory, I thought each book should be bigger. The idea should be bigger. So the first Ewan Who is just general essays about Doctor Who, because I didn't have the confidence nor the profile to get essays on every story for the first book.
Yeah.
So the first book is just essays on Doctor Who. The second one is an essay about every single story and a load of spin-off stuff as well. The third one, I thought, you've got to go bigger than that. So it's the whole of British telefantasy. And sometime later this year, I'm planning to start work on the whole of British cult film.
Ooh.
So my trajectory is that each book I do should be bigger in some way than the last. Not necessarily a bigger book, but a bigger idea. And well, then I think that's where my own trajectory will stop.
Well, I was just going to say, you know, you may say not a bigger book, but I can see those books from where I'm sitting. They're laying on their sides at the moment. And the first book is about half the size of one volume of Contact. And if I put both volumes of Contact together, they're about the same thickness as You and Who Else.
So they are actually turning into bigger books, but that wasn't necessarily the idea. It was just the idea of behind the book. The concept for each book had to be bigger. Because it's always been, you know, it's always been something with me that I think if you do another thing that's like something you've done before, in some ways you have to better what you did before.
Mm, yes.
Rather than just doing, you know, the same again or whatever. So although I think it's really nice that we're also doing books like Chris Bryant's currently doing the Target books, and John Davis did the Blake 7 book. So although I think it's great and it's proper and it's right that we're doing these kinds of things, on a personal level, that's something that I wouldn't necessarily have an interest in doing myself.
Mm.
So it's nice that we're spreading out.
Now, again, just looking at you and who else, it is the size of a small brick. Certainly it can't double in size, but I don't think it needs to. I think this size, there is just so much. I'm flicking through it now. There's so much in there from so many different people on so many different things. You can't flick to a random page and find something amazing.
It's a real dipper-inner, actually, isn't it?
Yeah, that's how I treat them.
Yeah, I don't think you could really read these things cover to cover, certainly not now, not with you and who else. You probably could with the Doctor Who ones, but no, not with you and who else, I don't think you could. And I suppose one of the ways you could criticize it is saying there's too much in there and you should cut out the flab and just leave the important stuff. But this is one of the joys of self-publishing, is that you can just say, look, no, it is the size it is. It covers what it covers, and it has all these essays in by all these different people. If somebody's enthused enough to want to write for it, then unless what they write is absolute drivel, I think there's a place for them in there. And the thing about all these essays is, and I think this is true even if they're talking about stuff that hasn't happened to you, I think the emotional connection is going to pretty much connect with anybody who's going to read the book. So even if they're writing about a series you've never seen and they're writing about it in terms that don't relate to your life, I think on an emotional level, what they're writing will connect with you in that way.
I was about to say the same thing. Even in terms of where it's not a series I've seen, but the way they're reacting to it is how I've reacted to another series. It's like, oh, I get that exactly. And then it makes me curious to go and watch that series because I think, well, if they like it like that, oh, maybe it's worth my time, you know, so it's useful in that way.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Coming back to going with a publisher or being self-published, are there pros and cons to either that you've come across?
Oh, being with a publisher gets you a much higher profile and you'll sell a lot more copies. Simple as that.
Okay.
But being self-published, you know, the pros of that is it stays in print, and that's a big thing. And you get to be in control of how much money you make and where it goes. I mean, not that I'm saying I've ever had any problems with that. Obviously, Milk, absolutely fastidious about those things. But you know what I mean? I can choose the charity that gets to benefit from these books. And the way it works is slightly different now from the way it worked before. But you get to be in charge of that. And you get to set the pricing structure. So you get to be in charge and you get to make sure that everything runs the way you want it to run. Because this is, I mean, Milk were exceptionally good about the two You and Who books that they did, you know, You and Who and Contact Has Been Made. But another publisher might well have said to me, You and Who else, you know, strip it of half of its page count.
Mm, exactly.
And I would have said, you know, stripping it of half of its page count, you might be able to then bump up the price so the charity gets an extra 50p per copy that's been sold, but I don't think you'd sell anything like as many copies because I don't think you'd have the enthusiasm for it as you do when you've got 150 different people writing for it. And, you know, however many people are reading it, everybody who's reading it is pretty much reacting the same and saying there's such a breadth of variety of experience in this book, you have to really immerse yourself in it, even if as a dipper-inner, in order to sort of fully get the emotional impact of what's happening with the essays.
Yeah, and not just the breadth of the experiences, but the breadth of the stories, because each essay is on a different show. If you lose an essay, you lose that show.
Well, exactly. That was something I didn't want to do. There are, you know, I had a great big list. You know, you saw the list
of
things that I would have quite liked the book to cover. And there were, I think, something like maybe a dozen things on that list that didn't get picked up. But all the really important ones did, and most of the less important but more interesting ones did too. So I don't think there's many things that didn't make it into the book that really needed to be in there. I think with something like 150 different TV programs covered across 60 years, I think we've pretty much covered most of the bases that people would have expected.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, look, as we come to the end of the interview, I'm going to ask you probably the hardest question.
Oh my God, do you think these questions haven't been hard so far?
Oh, these were easy in comparison, and you'll know why when I ask the question. And the question
You're not going to ask me to choose my favourite baby.
Almost. Which of the books that you've put together have you been most satisfied by? Might not be your favourite, but most satisfied.
Oh, yeah, okay, that's fair enough. But do you know what? In a way, the very first one, because to go through, because it took something like 2.5 years from start to actually being in print, and to actually see a book in print with a publisher, even if it's a small press publisher, is such a beautiful moment. But in terms of what I set out to accomplish and what I think I did, you and who else?
Yeah.
Because Doctor Who's my thing, and it's not easy, but it is, relatively speaking, easier to do something on Doctor Who because, you know, you're playing in your own sandpit.
Yeah.
But to go to something like British Telefantasy, because I'm not a Telefantasy fan. You know, a lot of my favourite other programmes have got nothing to do with science fiction or horror or whatever at all. And so there's a lot of stuff in this book that's kind of really outside of my sandpit. But I wanted to do it because I just thought that after you'd done Doctor Who, this was just the next logical step. And I also knew it would strike a chord so that it, because obviously you're also thinking at the same time, you want to sell as many copies as possible so you can make some money for the charities. So, you know, that was the other thing you're thinking about. So I knew it would strike a chord. So this was something I wanted to do, even though it was going to be a lot less easy for me to do it. And the size of it as well, because I wasn't expecting it. I thought I'd maybe get 100 essays. I wasn't expecting nearer 200. So the size of it and the fact that it was a lot more of a stretch for me to work on means that when I got to the end of it and it came out, and I think it's a damn good book, You and Who Else is the one that probably has brought me the most satisfaction.
Right, yes, because it really is, listeners, the size of a small brick. That is not actually an exaggeration.
Yeah. And it's the same colour as well.
Yeah, well, if you live in a reddish brick house, yes. Yes.
Yes.
When you were talking there, I was thinking, when you were going through the essays for You and Who Else, were you consciously thinking, oh, here's a show I've not watched, or here's a show I have watched, and could you even throw a percentage at how many you had and hadn't watched?
Oh, I've watched fewer than half of them. I'll tell you that.
Okay.
Maybe it's about 60-40, something like that. Mm. Perhaps even higher. I couldn't say. But yeah, there were a lot of essays talking about things I didn't know. But what I would do before I sat down and read each one would I would open up pages for that show on IMDb and Wikipedia, and I'd familiarise myself with everything I needed to. And then as I was going through the essays, every time a character name or an actor's name came up, if it wasn't something I knew, I would check, you know, for the spelling and to find out who it was and to make sure that what the person was writing in the essay corresponded with what was on Wikipedia and IMDb. Just because, you know, that's kind of what an editor has to do anyway.
Yeah.
But also so that even though I'm reading about TV series I haven't watched for those 60% or whatever it was, I've read enough of it by this point that I'm familiar enough with what the concepts are that I can see that what the person's writing in the essay corresponds with what somebody who's reading the essay who will have seen the program will be thinking about.
Yeah, and you can see, listeners, why it was a hell of a lot of work, you know, because not only is it a big book, but you're also doing that for the essays, which you wouldn't be necessarily doing for Doctor Who, because you just know it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Oh, God, 175 essays, and I've got to say, they probably took me, you know, an hour each to go through, even if they were the really simple ones,
yeah.
And some of them will have taken me 2 or 3 hours.
Yeah, yeah. But all for a good cause.
Well, yeah.
I think, was it Ian Martin from our show who suggested the cause for You and Who Else?
Yeah, he kind of was. He'd suggested that for something else, but we carried on. It was the 10th anniversary of Rose being on the telly. Ian Martin just emailed me out of the blue and said, you know what we ought to do is have a thing on Facebook where everybody watches Rose at 7 p.m. on the 10th anniversary and donates a tenner to charity. And I said, do you know what? That's a really good idea. Why don't you just, you know, make a page for it on Facebook and go for it? And he said, well, yeah, if I did that, you know, probably about 3 people would do it. But he said to me, if you do that, you'll get lots more because this was before Ian was doing the podcast, and I was doing the podcast, and I was writing for Starburst, so, you know, yeah, I probably reach more people.
Of course.
And so I said to him, okay, let's do that. And I set up a page for it, and I said, right, what charity will it be? And he said to me, well, what was the charity, because 10th anniversary of Rose, that Russell T Davies chose for when he was appeared on the Toby Haydock Who's Round? And he said, I think it was the Terence Higgins Trust. So I wrote to Toby and said, what was it? Was it Terence Higgins? And Toby wrote back and said, yeah, it was Terence Higgins. And so we said, right, for the Terence Higgins Trust. And then the morning after, we got about a dozen of us, I think, got emails from the Terence Higgins Trust saying, right, we got £500 of unexpected donations last night. Did something happen that we don't know about?
Wow. That's awesome.
So, yeah. So, apart from the fact that it was lovely to realize that just something so simple on Facebook had raised, you know, not all of that £500, but certainly a large percentage of it. And then that very same night, I didn't actually watch Rose at 7 o'clock because I was busy doing something else, which was launching the book, You and Who Else. So, when I launched the book, it struck me, well, with timing like that, the charity for this one had to be Terence Higgins Trust. Yeah. So, yeah, indirectly, Ian Martin suggested the charity.
Awesome. Awesome. Well, look, thank you so much for joining us today on the show. It's been really good to go back over You and Who Else and the other You and Who books, and, of course, the new book as well, Hating to Love. I know I'll be picking up a copy as soon as I can. Late April, you're thinking?
Yeah, certainly before the midpoint of the year. I'm not sure how quickly these essays are going to come in. I'm assured they're going to be in within the next sort of 2 or 3 weeks, but we'll see. But, you know, I'd rather it's a good book than one that's put together quickly. So if it doesn't come out till June, it doesn't come out till June. It's on the near horizon, put it that way.
Brilliant, brilliant. Well, I am looking forward to it. And thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, you're welcome. Have I lived up to my reputation as the guy who just can't shut up?
Well, I think achievement unlocked.
And I'm going to stop you in your tracks and say, do you want another exclusive?
Oh, well, yes, please.
Well, after Hating to Love comes out, and I'm not looking at getting this out until about a year later, but using some of the same people, but not all of them, because it's a slightly different angle, so I'm going to try and choose the people who I think can cover that angle more thoroughly. So it's going to be another book in what might turn out to be another series of books along similar themes to one another, but this time, instead of looking at the 52 worst Doctor Who stories, we're going to be looking at the most influential Doctor Who stories.
Interesting.
It's going to be called Stitches in Time, and it's essentially, I think the number's going to be around 35 or 40, but it's going to be the 40 stories that had the biggest impact on the series in terms of introducing themes, or establishing themes, I should say. Because it's not necessarily going to be the first story in which something appears, but it's going to be the story in which that thing is consolidated so that it becomes a part of the series. So that's going to be another book following this one, Stitches in Time, probably in about a year's time.
That sounds very interesting too. You've got me hooked, JR.
Well, I hope so. Yeah, but I just sort of set that wheels in motion on that one this week. So I thought, well, that's got to be the way we finish the podcast tonight.
Well, you've heard it here first. Thank you again so much for taking the time. It's quite late at night over there in the UK and early in the morning here.
Thanks for having me on, Rob. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Always good to chat.
You too. Cheers then.
The A to Z of Doctor Who, Part 3, C. Castellan from The Five Doctors, The. I recently spent a lovely evening with Paul Jericho, the actor who brilliantly portrayed an anonymous Castellan in The Five Doctors, at his cottage on the South Downs. Invited to interview him, but also to stay for an evening, I'd brought a DVD of a movie with me, a 1990s horror called That Casket. As we opened a nice bottle of Merlot, I checked with Jericho if he had in fact already seen it. He shook his head. "I have never seen That Casket before," he affirmed. I asked him if the village newspaper reports were correct, that he'd been blackballed from the village fate committee because he'd cheated in Dr. Thorpe's tombola the previous year. The doctor's lying. He wants revenge. Ultimately, I had to ask him if it was okay to talk about the infamous mind probe sequence. No, not the mind probe. Fair enough, I said. Let's just watch the movie and have a nice drink. We enjoyed the film, sitting in companionable silence and occasionally chuckling together at the funny bits or at some low production values. At the end of the night, I asked him why people mocked his stilted, stressless and unemotional delivery of his dialogue in The Five Doctors. I've absolutely no idea, he said, shaking his head, a single solitary tear snaking its way down his once proud cheek. Castra Valva. With the benefit of hindsight, you have to ask yourself who exactly was it who thought that the best way to draw a line under the Tom Baker era and present an utterly new hero to the TV-watching public was to have Davison's pleasant, open-faced Fifth Doctor lying insensible on the floor of Studio B for two episodes. There's an electrifying moment in Part 1 where, after some quite good impersonations of previous incarnations, the Fifth Doctor rounds on Adric and says, "Don't you understand? The regeneration is failing." I think we've all had a couple of hangovers that have felt the same. The story also gave us Anthony Ainley in top form, playing a ghostly wise old man called the Portreeve, in addition to his nascent performance as the Master, which reached new levels of villainy here as he trapped Adric in a mesh of thin, flimsy-looking wires and used his mathematical genius to, make a tapestry. Meanwhile, the Doctor, Nyssa and Tegan spent their time in Castra Valva battling a recursive occlusion, running along two bits of corridor which seemed bafflingly linked, almost as if the entire set was simply comprised of three rooms and two corridors. Chelonians, the... An oft-recycled criticism of the new series is that there have been no memorable returning villains or monsters created in 10 years of television, with a sort of grumbling concession that the Weeping Angels are as good as it's got. Yet Gareth Roberts' new adventure novels, featuring the Chelonians, a race of warmongering turtles, have demonstrated that new monsters can be done well, and in a context which justifies repeated appearances. Also, the Chelonians are canon, because they were mentioned in the Pandorica Opens. Admittedly, nothing else from either the New Adventures or the BBC novels were on a level with the creation of the Chelonians, but just occasionally it can be done. I mean, are the Maya coming back? Are they bollocks? Chibnall, Chris. We enter the final two-year stage of the wait for Chris Chibnall's arrival as showrunner of Doctor Who, with fandom utterly divided over the thorny issue of who precisely could replace him. Fans are rewatching his new Who episodes with a new keenness and certain critical fervour which wasn't there previously. 42 has been cautiously reappraised as not completely awful, and there are those people who quite like Dinosaurs on a Spaceship. I've seen it twice, but I couldn't tell you what that one's about. But no one likes the Silurian one. That's pretty much where we are. No one knows what Chibnall would do with full control of the series, although if Broadchurch gives any indication, the Doctor would be exiled to a Dorset seaside town and there'd be a long-running, highly convoluted story arc about the death of a major character. Oh no, hang on, that was Moffat, wasn't it? Maybe Chibbers will go comedy. Maybe he'll go Hinchcliffe. Maybe he'll go for Hawaiian shirts and big cigars, but as we all know, he's no fan of JNT, publicly chiding him on live television in 1986 because he didn't like the Trial of a Time Lord. And if there's one thing that'll bring down a TV executive's career, it's the hatred of a spotty git in a shiny suit. Actually, we do know what Chibnall is capable of because he was left to run the 2006 Doctor Who adult spin-off Torchwood, which was fucking awful. Clara. Clara Oswald made the Doctor into a man, giving the teenage Time Lord a very formative experience in a deserted barn. Then, nearing the end of his first incarnation, when he decided to run away from Gallifrey, Clara helped him pick the best TARDIS to hotwire. At regular intervals throughout his next incarnations, she would crop up to rescue him, whether he noticed it or not, until he finally met her properly in his 11th body, when she became his companion, although he didn't let on that he'd known her for over 1,000 years already, and indeed sort of pretended to not know who she was and sort of specifically wonder who she was. They travelled together, and when the Doctor spent 1,000 years in the town of Christmas defending Trenzalore, Clara was by his side too. Thus, by the time Clara faced the Raven, the Doctor had known her his whole 2,000-year life. So anyone who doesn't understand why the Doctor was so upset he'd spent billions of years punching his way through a diamond wall needs to consider exactly how significant Clara is to him. His longest companion, his oldest friend and ally. Easily the hottest companion by a country mile. Now the unkillable Clara is having new adventures with the immortal me in an impregnable TARDIS. There's no real sense of peril in that format, is there? Cliffhangers. Few would argue that a major part of the success of the show for the first 26-year classic run was the weekly cliffhanger, ending the drama on a moment of pure jeopardy which placed the Doctor or his current companion in mortal peril. Who can forget the radiation meter flicking over into danger on Skaro? Tom Baker being drowned by a vengeful Goth. And I'm not talking about outside the coach and horses one night either. Or Peter Davison's, "So you see, Stutz, I'm not going to let you stop me now." When Colin Baker became the Doctor, the cliffhangers were part of BBC budget cuts, and he was only afforded two weekly options, screaming and writhing as a dangerous device invaded his brain, or shouting, "Perry," in a slightly camp manner. Things perked up in the McCoy era with the Dragonfire dangle, the Remembrance rumination, "I think I might have miscalculated," and the Fenric fear fillet, "We play the contest again, Time Lord." RTD and the Grand Moff have experimented with reviving the tradition in New Who, but in the RTD era you just got Tennant waving his bloody screwdriver around. The Stolen Ends cliffhanger, while gratuitous, felt at the time like the most exciting thing ever, and the end of the Pandorica Opens was mind-blowing. But for the most part, cliffhangers just aren't as blood-curdlingly exciting for me as they used to be, possibly because I'm no longer 7 years old. Curse of the Black Spot. Some people seem to think that this Season 6 episode was egregiously bad. With the benefit of hindsight, it's hard to recall the specific grievances. I mean, yes, Amy's cocky hectoring was a little bit much by this point, but it was a solid story with narrative cohesion, drama, peril, and a satisfying logical conclusion. If you don't like this, for God's sake, don't watch 98% of episodes from the Russell T. Davies era. Cybermen. The Cybermen were originally the inhabitants of the planet Mondas, Earth's twin planet, who had, like us, developed a love and reliance upon technology, which ultimately went too far until the entire race gave up their organic existence to be almost mechanical with concomitant loss of an emotional interior life. They liked logic, order, besieging small bases, and slowly evolved into a primarily warlike race of ruthless expansionists. Then, in 2006, Tom McRae reinvented them as a bunch of mindless idiots from a parallel Earth, who, under the control of basically Davros, as portrayed by Trigger from Only Fools and Horses, went the same way in a rapid yet graceless fall from intelligence. Something to do with earpieces that make little metal handles around your head. The Cybermen escaped from the parallel Earth in Army of Ghosts, but were all sent back there in the tear-jerking final moments of Doomsday. Then, suddenly, somehow, next time they turn up, they're in space? Eh? Then there's some that... but then, and porridge, and they can move really fast. The current Cybermen are a confused mishmash of two different and conflicting mythologies, but the only thing people can really agree on is the mythology of the programme's once proud second-best monsters is now what TV theorists and academics would term a goat fuck.
7 years ago,
we choose to go to the moon, and this became an evergreen.
That one day, this nation will rise.
The Master, my half-brother from another mother, from the time planet Gallifrey. Have you come to Earth to shrink more humans? Or do you have some other dastardly plan hidden in your nefarious beard?
Oh, tut, tut now, Doctor. You'll never know. You don't have the balls to...
You shot him!
You shot me!
Yeah, I shoot people now. It's a thing I do. Shooting people is cool.
The American version of Doctor Who. Turning people off science fiction for decades to come.
This is the TARDIS, an iPhone that is smaller on the outside than the inside. And in it I travel in space and time. And Utah. The only question is...
Does it have this Snapchat?
It's a time machine that can go anywhere in time and space. What outlet mall do you want to see first? Let's see, I'll have the double-double cheeseburger, extra-large fries, of course, big wrap, big double, big nugget.
This is Doctor Who. Red, white, and blue.
Super jumbo soda and three desserts. I'm on a diet.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to The Letter Lords.
Hello, I'm Bob Fleming from the Proctor Who podcast.
And I'm Jim Cameron from the Crinoid podcast, and collectively we are The Letter Lords.
The Letter Lords.
Indeed, and this time we shall be talking about the letters from issue 497 of Doctor Who magazine. That's the one with Paul McGann on the front.
The April edition.
The April edition, as you so rightly, 2016.
Yeah. First of all, Jim, can I just say this? I've never been a Doctor Who magazine purchaser for a long time, believe it or not, which I know is sacrilege in the Doctor Who fandom world, but I got a bit bored of it. And I think since we've been in the Letter Lords, this is our third episode, the show's third episode and our third episode. This week has summed it up for me, I think, why I stopped sort of buying Doctor Who magazine. It's very... I'm trying to find a polite word for it. Just particularly in the letters, there's nothing controversial. It's all very backslapping. There's no, I'm not saying to be controversial for controversy's sake, but it's there's no sort of critique. It's just, I love Doctor Who. I love Stephen Moffat. I love everything about Doctor Who. It's all brilliant. And particularly, I think this month's magazine, I think we both struggled to sort of find anything that's, you know, not just bland and sort of BBC ticked off. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, it toes the party line, doesn't it, the magazine, generally speaking?
Yeah, and I'm not knocking it because I've really enjoyed the last three I've bought from us, you know, doing this. It's been a nice excuse for me to buy. In fact, I've subscribed now, you know, on a monthly basis because there's some great bits in there. But I think that's why I stopped reading it initially because it is, like you're saying, just there, that line, toeing the party line. And I think that's why it sometimes gets a bit... I don't like the extreme. I don't like people slagging off Doctor Who just for slagging off sake. But there's no sort of critique in there. Do you know what I mean?
No, I think what we'll have, you know, hopefully in more interesting months is people asking interesting questions rather than just gushing about stuff.
I know, but yeah, we can only work with the tools that we're given.
we can, yeah, as a pair of tools, we can only work with the tools we're given.
So, yeah, well, there's plenty to talk about in it, I think, from our own sort of personal opinions, really.
Yeah, there's lots of sort of broad themes have come up. And as you can imagine, this is the magazine that came out after the news about Moffat going and Chris Chibnall eventually arriving. So yeah. That's, you know, basically what people are talking about. And there's a little bit about, you know, whether Capaldi should stay on and that kind of stuff. So we'll work our way through it. But let's start with, it's a very, very Irish name here. I think it's Ewan Daly.
I'm going for Ewan as well.
Yes, excellent. What did you call it earlier?
Eggnog. But that was just me being terribly bad at reading, which I have a reputation for, apparently, Jim.
I had heard this, yes. So, Eggnog Daily says, when I heard the rumours in 2015 about a year with no Doctor Who, I will admit I was upset. When it was confirmed that the show was taking a year break with only one special airing and a full series in spring 2017, I was even more concerned. I questioned what I was going to do in this dark year with no new content. However, I realised that I won't struggle as much as I thought I would. We'll have brand new DWMs every month filled with fantastic content and a brand new comic adventure and the Doctor Who The Complete History part work. Not heard that word before.
No, that's a new one, isn't it, I think? Part work.
Yes. Yeah, I've heard of artwork.
I think it's...
And parts.
It's that overpriced sort of book, which is actually quite good. Have you seen that?
Oh,
all?
Yes. In a gazillion parts.
Yeah, million parts. Like, the first three were, like, 4 pence. And every book every book thereafter is, like, £23 or something.
Once they've dragged you in, yes. Yes, yes, he goes on to say, plus, there are countless Big Finish audios I've yet to listen to, and a ton of BBC and Virgin books to read. I think a year without Doctor Who on television will be a great way to catch up on past releases.
Yeah, well, no, I get it. I mean, I don't know how you felt. I think we've already touched on it when we've spoken in the last sort of three episodes, that when I found out Doctor Who was getting a break till next year, I was quite happy about it. You know, kind of for the reasons that Ewan's put in there. But I just think it needs it. I think it needs that Doctor Who to come back with a bit more of a bang. And it also needs to come back, I think, at the better time slot. It's going to come back next year in the spring when it's not up against the big players like we've talked about before.
Yeah.
But there's so much out there. I mean, it summed it up for me. I've been really sad. You know, I mean, you know, I'm rock and roll, Jim. You know, like I'm in abandoned that.
I know, yes.
Well, on Wednesday night, I decided to categorise with spreadsheets my Big Finish Doctor Who collection.
Phew, rock and roll.
No, I'm crazy while drinking chamomile tea. And it struck me how much there is out there that's not related just to the show that's on television.
Of course,
you know, we've always known there's so much, and it was brilliant that, you know, all that sort, you know, the Big Finish, the Virgin books kept us going through the dark times, the 16 years of dark times. And I think this is a really good point. It's kind of, he was very negative about it, which I wasn't personally, but then put a positive spin on his second paragraph, you know, saying there is so much Doctor Who out there to listen to catch up on. And most of it's brilliant. You know, what the Big Finish guys do, stunning work. And it's only getting better, obviously getting David Tennant, Alex Kingston, John Hurt, getting Tom Baker, all these things. It's just growing all the time and getting so much bigger. I think Big Finish in particular, not just the stuff from previous, but the new stuff that they're bringing out. There's plenty of Doctor Who to be looking at, you know, for this year, really.
Yeah, there's some big, high-profile new ranges coming out, aren't there, like you say, with those characters.
Yeah.
I've never been big into a Big Finish, to be honest. I like some of the stuff I heard, but it's just, you know, for some reason, it isn't really for me. But what I intend to do is I'm probably going to go through and watch all the John Pertwee TV stories.
Yeah.
I don't know why, really, I just fancy it. And there's a ton of other stuff that isn't anything to do with Doctor Who to catch up on as well. And as you will know, doing the the weekly podcast when the series is actually running, it can get quite hectic, kind of trying to fit your normal life in with all that stuff.
I love doing the podcast stuff, and I love talking about Doctor Who with yourself and obviously the Doctor Who guys and anyone that wants to talk about Doctor Who, you know. But it's the weekly thing, you're a lot more involved in it as well. It's a lot more stressful. Like, I know in our sort of...
Yeah.
Break times that I think most podcasts do, to look back at classics and Big Finish and books and things like that. But there's just so much out there, like I say, that you can carry on with. I've been really getting back into my Big Finish, and it was something that was just so good when Sirens of Time first came out in 1999, I think it was, when the Big Finish boys kicked off. To have something you can listen to, some new Doctor Who with proper Doctors, it was ace. And they've just gone from strength to strength thereafter. So there's plenty of stuff to be kicking on with this year. So I think it's an exciting year of listening to alternative sort of Doctor Who, catching up, getting the most out of these sort of books and audio players that you can, ready for next year, which I think is going to be a very strong season.
Yeah, well, I hope so. I mean, should we talk about Stephen Moffat finishing off?
Yeah.
Because that's one of the themes that's come up in here, isn't it?
Yeah. he's pretty much just about that, isn't it? So, looking at a Stephen Moffat letter, really. I think there's Simon Darley from Doncaster, Northern lad. Good lad.
Well done for being born in the north.
Well, but he's sort of bordering the north south.
Well played.
Sort of bordering the north there, Jim. He says just a few lines to wish Stephen Moffat best wishes for the future following the announcement of his departure. Without him, would we have had the 11th and 12th Doctors as we know them and love them? Or for that matter, would we have even had the War Doctor, Amy, Rory, the Paternoster Gang, Clara, Danny, Kate, Osgood or Missy? As for the incoming Chris Chibnall, I confess I've never seen Broadchurch, but I love Born and Bred. It's reassuring to know that the future is in safe hands. I agree with that. But yeah, I think Moffat, he's brought so much to Doctor Who, it's unbelievable. Not just from his, you know, tenure as the head of Doctor Who, but his scripts before that and the RTD times, or, you know, Russell T Davies times, were, in my opinion, the best scripts, you know, of Doctor Who, that sort of era, really.
Yeah, I think they were too. And in general, I've actually much preferred Stephen Moffat's tenure to that of Russell T Davies. Yeah. I just found it a lot more compelling than the other stuff. So I think, you know, we've got a lot to thank him for. He cast two excellent doctors in Matt Smith and Peter Capaldi. And, some extraordinary episodes he's created, and then a lot of great episodes under his watch, you know, even ones that he hasn't written himself. There's been a lot of good content that's come out under his stewardship. So great, you know. I mean, I think it is time, well, certainly by the end of another series, it will be time for him to go.
Yeah.
But, you know, he's had a good run. I haven't loved all of it, but I've loved a lot of it. And I hope he goes out with a bang.
I'm sure he will. Really? I've no, you know, I always sort of say some prog to a kid. Well, when we're sort of doubting Moffat's ability as a writer, which we should never do, you know, in Moffat we trust. He's done so much brilliant work for Doctor Who. And just when he names the characters, like, he introduced the War Doctor. Now, I know that was put on him, but then to cast John Hurt, it was an absolute stroke of genius, and it was fantastic, that 50th special. And it made it a bit different, that, introducing a bit more mythology to Doctor Who in the War Doctor. Yeah. You know, and Osgood, she's great. Missy, you know, I know she's... I've gone a bit off her a little bit, and I know you weren't a big fan, but to a lot of Doctor Who fans, she's a, you know, she's been a great master, and that's a revelation itself, making the master a lady. You know, it's he's done some really good work.
He has. I mean, this is not a kind of a bland era of Doctor Who that people will forget about.
No.
You know, some people may not have liked it that much, but they can't deny that it's, well, I don't know, special, I suppose you could say, or certainly distinctive.
Yeah, well, it's given us podcasters something to talk about.
Well, that's for sure.
You know, it's been ace, and it's been a thrill. But I'm interested to see what Chris Chibnall brings to the party, and it's so long off that, you know, it feels a bit weird talking about it, because we've got, you know, another couple of Christmas specials or whatever and a new series. But I've actually just watched Broadchurch recently. And I loved it. I thought it was brilliant. You know, I look back at Chris Chibnall's work he's done on Doctor Who and Torchwood, and I quite like his episodes, just like them. But one thing that doesn't strike me from Chris Chibnall with his episodes that have been in Doctor Who, like, I know you're not a massive fan of Power of Three, but, like, I like that, and 42, and I quite like The Hungry Earth, and most of the stuff he's done has been good. You know, it's been good, strong Doctor Who. But what it's not been is Stephen Moffat in RTD's era. Do you see what I mean? Like, Moffat was the one that was always crying out, you know, everyone wanted Moffat to be the new, you know, head of Doctor Who, because he stood out so much. Now, no one's done that in Moffat's tenure, I don't believe, apart from Jamie Matheson's one episode, Mummy on the Orient Express and Flatline. I think them two stood out, but not as dramatic as Moffat. But watching Broadchurch, you know, I've watched, I think, two episodes off finishing series two. It's some gripping, stunning, and well thought out television. I really enjoyed it. A hell of a lot of Doctor Who people in it. Like, Jesus Christ. I thought I was watching an episode of Doctor Who for a second. But yeah, I thought that put a lot of faith for me into Chris Chibnall.
Yeah, I haven't seen Broadchurch, and unfortunately, someone gave away, you know, the person who did it. So until such a time as I can wipe my mind of that, you know, I'm not got no great desire to see it, because it kind of knows who done it.
It massively relies on that element, you know, who done it. And it's done so well. So, like I say, his stories were good in Doctor Who, but watching stuff he's done, and he's obviously a well-renowned name within the sort of television writing universe, I'm excited, Jim.
Yeah, I'm kind of I'm not unexcited about it. I mean, he wasn't my first choice, really.
Who was your first choice then?
I would have liked to seen Toby Whithouse because I really liked Being Human, and I think he proved he's a good showrunner for you know, genre TV. Plus, he was working with huge cast changes in that as well. Yeah. You'll go from one series to another, and you'll lose all your key cast, and then others will turn up and take their place, kind of thing. So it's not unlike what happens in Doctor Who, really.
Yeah,
I thought it'd be a good choice, and I really like most of his stories he's written for Doctor Who, you know, more than I have Chris Chibnall's. But then we don't know really whether or not that's going to be a good signal of the kind of stuff he'll be writing when he takes control.
Well,
but
yeah.
I would say that he is probably going to sit somewhere between Russell T. Davis and Stephen Moffat in terms of being more populist probably than Stephen Moffat, but you know, hopefully with a kind of a style all of his own, really.
Yeah, no, I agree. I mean, as well as experiences, well, his success with Broadchurch, obviously a big thing, but I mean, he was the sort of head of, well, kind of the head of Torchwood first two series when it started. And again, that was quite, you know, I quite like Torchwood. I know it gets a bit of a bad rap, but it was quite, it was what it was. It was quite different. It was quite new. Do you know what I mean? It was, you know, it was quite, he's going to give us new Doctor Who, if you see what I mean. He's going to give us something different, which I think we've been longing for a little while now, which is what the classic series relied on, you know, change of producers and script editor and all that, and a, you know, change of look and a change of direction. So I'm really excited.
Yeah. I mean, it's always relied on change, isn't it, Doctor Who? And as I said earlier, I think it's high time, really. Although I enjoy what Stephen Moffat does, you know, is time for a new broom. But one of the questions that comes out of that is, should it be entirely a clean sweep, or should Capaldi stay on for a bit longer?
Well, we have a letter, don't we, from Paddy Ryan. Do you want to take this one on, Jim?
Yeah, we'll do. Paddy Ryan from Newry in County Down says, just as we have witnessed an astonishingly good series of Doctor Who, the rumours begin to circulate that Peter Capaldi might be leaving. I have to say that Heaven Sent was possibly the greatest single episode of any TV series, let alone Doctor Who. The man is staggeringly good in the role. He is everything from steely determination to tragic pathos. I think it's fair to say that he is the best since Tom Baker, and the show would be a lot worse off without him at the helm of the TARDIS. And I think one of the other letters wonders whether or not you know, he could stay. Jennifer Sheldon, I think, wonders whether or not he could stay on even with a new showrunner. I think, personally, I think it would be interesting. I would like to see more of him.
Yeah.
And I'd also like to see the slight difference, or maybe more than the slight difference, that you might get with a new showrunner writing for him.
I mean, I'd like to see Paul McGann. I've had this theory for ages, right? Don't be wrong, I do agree what you're saying. I'd like to see Capaldi continue, because I've loved him. He's been brilliant. I'd like to see him with a different head of Doctor Who, or head writer. But I've got this theory, Jim. Right, so Doctor Who has changed into people that you've seen in his past. So, like, Peter Capaldi is a prime example, from the guy from Fires of Pompeii, yeah, taking his face. Lala Ward taking the face of Queen Astra. Astra from
Princess.
Yeah, so she took that face. What if the Doctor quite liked the face of Paul McGann, yeah, and regenerates him back into Paul McGann for the next Doctor? How do you like that theory?
Well, that would be interesting.
How would you feel about that? Would you be all right with that? Or,
well, it'd be slightly odd in terms of canon, wouldn't it, to have the same Doctor twice?
Yeah.
But I mean, he's a great actor, and you know, I'd like to see more of him in the role, and that would be one way of doing it. I mean, it's probably only going to be a source of confusion for the older fan.
Yeah, but what I like about it is that, well, I think what's made me hungry for it is the fact that when we got the Night of the Doctor, you know, when Moffat did that, legend, so give Paul McGann his send-off, do you know what I mean? And just seeing him again, I was just like, well, you know, you could, if you really wanted to, because it was such a long time ago, the TV movie, obviously heavy Doctor Who fans like ourselves, I think we'd really enjoy it, yeah? The new fans aren't going to know about it, and all he's got to say is just one line when he regenerates, I like this face, that's it, and carry on. I just think, I don't know.
Well, there is a bit of a precedent set in the Day of the Doctor, isn't there?
What was that?
When Tom Baker, his face returns in what's presumably a future incarnation of the Doctor.
Yeah, so there we go.
He goes back and visits his old favourites, he says, doesn't he?
Bring back McGann. But, sorry.
Well, it's been seeded already.
But I digress. But yeah, Capaldi, I just like to see a whole new Doctor Who, a whole new, you know, thing going on when Chibnall takes over. And I think as a head writer, when you take him on a show, I think you deserve that as well. You know, you sort of, you go from square one with everything. It's like taking on a new, being a new, I'm talking about football again, Jim. Why am I doing that? That's terrible. But, you know, you take on a team, you know, you want to make your changes, make it how you want. And, you know, if your lead striker is, doesn't make any sense what I'm saying right now. So I'm going to shut up. But yeah, I think being the head right, you need to take on your new team. Do you know what I mean?
Mm. Yeah, I mean, what will probably happen, yeah, is that he'll have a clean slate to work from as her second. Well, I suppose he's only ever, we've only had one changeover once, haven't we, from RTD to Moffat. But RTD, of course, had a clean slate as he kicked the whole thing off again. But I don't know. I mean, it's, you'd think that would be, it would make it quicker for Chris Chibnall to mould the show in whatever image he wants to mould into. Mm. If he gets to choose a new Doctor and formulate the character from scratch. And we've just heard, haven't we, that the new companion has been cast.
Yes, there's rumours.
We don't
there's
know
rumors.
Who it is yet. Yeah. But that will give a new lease of life to Capaldi for this final Moffat season, whether or not it's Capaldi's final season. There will be a different slant on Capaldi, because necessarily things will be different if he's got a different companion. So, you know, that might be almost the best of both worlds, to see a slightly different Capaldi before he bows out, and then a clean slate for Chibnall when he takes it on. So I don't particularly mind either way. I mean, I do kind of feel that there are too many Doctors now. But
there's a lot of Doctors.
I mean, the alternative is the show stopping. So
yeah,
I think it's better to have lots of people having played the Doctor than it is for the show to stop. But I think, you know, it's because perhaps I don't stay on as long as I would like in the role.
Well, yeah,
and the turnover is a bit quicker than that I would personally think is ideal.
Well, I think it's I think it's attention span for the time we live in, and I'll put this analogy in the form of people that listen to music, right? Because that's the kind of, I understand music, so I'm gonna I don't understand football, which is why analogies about football are rubbish. But but if you, for example, when we were younger, right, you didn't have downloads, you didn't have, you couldn't obtain music for free, shall I say. Okay. So if you heard a band on the radio, you heard something, you had to make an investment in something called an album. So you had to actually physically buy that, you know, from a shop. So you would listen to it because you bought it. Do you see what I mean? Mm.
Yeah.
Whereas nowadays you can, you know, people, I've got it, Spotify and things like that. You can subscribe to whatever, you can get things for free, and you will give it about 30 seconds to a minute. Oh, but you know, that's how people sort of operate now. And if you don't like that song, you're not going to give them a chance. Whereas before, like I say, it was very different. You invested in it, you know, financially. So you
kind of force yourself to like it if you can.
Well, not force yourself, but you know,
if it's not as good as you, when you buy a thing and you're disappointed, you'll persevere and hopefully with the end result, liking it more.
To the point where you sort of listen to an album, you know, three or four times. I still do that now. So if I get an album, you've got to do it about three or four times to sort of give it a justice, or, you know, give it an actual review. I'm sure you do the same as well, Jim.
Oh, yeah.
But, you know, from speaking to younger people, or, you know, how people, not just younger people, but people that have adapted into the modern day world, which I don't think I have, it's, they'll give it 30 seconds or a minute of a song and that's it, which I think applies now to the Doctor. You know, it's a couple of years, 3 years is quite a long time now for Doctor Who, and you're done.
Mm.
Because people's attention spans are very different, I think.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. Keep showing them something new and they'll keep watching.
Yeah, I think it applies to life in general. So there you go.
There you are. Deep, man.
Deep, man. Deep. That was well deep. So I think we've covered most stuff. Oh no, one thing I want to actually speak about, Jim, was the letters of sort of, you know, talking about Chibnall and Moffat, is Moffat writing for Chibnall and Russell T. Davies coming back and writing a couple of scripts for Doctor Who. How do you feel about that, Mike?
Well, I think it would be a while before Stephen Moffat would want to do that, particularly as he's kind of gone on record, his overall broad arc for Doctor Who finished with the end of series 9, and then, you know, he knew he was going to be writing the Christmas special, but he thought that was going to be it. So now he's got another year worth of content, including two Christmas specials to write, and I hope his creative juices will be flowing enough to fill that with some good stuff. I'm sure they will.
Yeah.
But that might just be, you know, a bridge too far, really, for him writing anything in the first few years of Chibnall.
No, I agree. It's like a pub landlord. The rule of the pub landlord, right, Jim? I don't know if you know this. I'm giving you more facts. Is these analogies and facts are brilliant. If you leave a pub as a landlord, yeah, you can't go back in that pub for 6 months because, obviously, you know, the new landlord's trying to make a change.
Okay.
I'd like to see Moffat writing for Chibnall, not next series, like we're saying, but, you know, a couple of years. But I'd love to see RTD back straight away doing a script.
Yeah, that'd be interesting. He's had a long absence, hasn't he?
Yeah, he's had a very long absence. And also, he's, you know, obviously worked quite closely with Chris Chibnall on, you know, Torchwood and various other projects as well. So I'd love to see an RTD script. I can't believe I'm saying that, but yeah, I would. It'd be ace under a... Well, he's just got no pressure. He's just a writer then. You know what I mean? There's my script, Mr. Head of Doctor Who. Have a go at that.
Yeah, I think it'd be really interesting. Because, yeah, by the time Chibnall starts, that'll be a long, long time since RTD's written anything for the show.
Yeah, it'd be nice to see something, you know, back from RTD, because he is a brilliant writer, absolutely brilliant writer, and the man that brought back Doctor Who and brought it back blazingly well.
Yeah, it'd be interesting. As I'd say, I think Chibnall's vision will be perhaps closer to RTD's than Stephen Moffat's. I don't know that for sure, but, you know, it kind of feels like that's how it will be. And that's what the show needs at the moment is, you know, the more populist touch, doesn't it, to get
it
more
does.
Back on seats.
But I do think it'd be a halfway house, though. I know maybe it might lean towards RTD, but I think it'd be a halfway house, and I'm quite looking forward to that, you know.
Yeah, but it's a long time before anything happens is the only frustrating
thing. A long time, Jim.
Yeah, I mean, it's a long time before he'd see even more Stephen Moffat, let alone Chris Chibnall.
Well, I've got a distraction from that.
Is it going on?
It's a gentleman called Gary Watson, who sent a rather strange letter, to say the least. But I'll read it out, and we'll go from there. So Gary Watson emailed, when the series returns on BBC One in 2017, I'd like to see, hopefully, the following. More information about Gus, the killer computer from Mummy on the Orient Express. The Doctor's still haunted by what happened to Amy and Rory. The show focusing on the Doctor and a reduction of darker tone. Well, pretty much you've just said darker tone and weird stuff. But anyway, and also I hope the BBC books will release more past Doctor novels featuring the first 11 Doctors. There haven't been many lately. Finally, here's hoping Peter Jackson directs an episode. Now, possibly Gary likes LSD.
Yeah,
it's really random.
A eclectic selection. Well, isn't it?
I think the reason why it stands out as much as sort of going through it, it's all like, yeah, I love Stephen Moffat. He's brilliant. Thank you very much, Stephen. Oh, and welcome, Chris. Hello. I can't wait to hear what you've got to do, you know, towing the line. And then suddenly some randomness is put in from Gary there, which I quite like.
Yeah.
So would you like to see Gus the Killer Computer back or make his conclusion from Mummy on the Orient Express, Jim?
Well, that and the Doctor being haunted by Amy Roy. I think the ship has sailed for both of those quite some time ago. I think it would be very odd to introduce either of those back again.
Amazing. And something about book releases. Do the BBC still do? Well, obviously, they still do. I know they were quite big on the books from current Doctors, weren't they? Particularly when it came back. So you had a lot of, you know, Eccleston and Tennant ones headed sort of by, was it Justin Richards who's a big...
Yeah.
Big sort of, you know, backer or basically the new Terence Dixon, you know, from Target, you know, version of the BBC books, like. But yeah, it's a strange wish list. Would you like to see? And also, would you like to see? I mean, I'd like to see Peter Jackson do a directing episode, even though I truly believe, particularly, well, every year it gets better, the direction on Doctor Who, and some fabulous directors have been in the last couple of series of Doctor Who.
Mm.
Peter Jackson, he's all right, isn't he?
Well, yeah, he's very good. It'd be quite a strange gig for him to do a shortish TV programme.
Yeah, I'd like to see him make Peter Capaldi a hobbit. It'd be interesting, wouldn't it?
Well, the problem is, if we're given a 45-minute script, we'll make it into a 7 3-hour epics.
Like he did with The Hobbit. The Hobbit's a really small book, and he did 17 hours on it.
Yeah.
But yeah, it'd be quite funny if you made Capaldi a hobbit, like they made David Tennant. Dobby Doctor off Harry Potter. But yeah, just wanted to read that out and tell you that's what people think and write down in word form.
Yeah, it's an interesting one, isn't it? I mean, there is a chance that Peter Jackson will direct something after that daft thing that went up online.
Yeah, well, obviously he's a fan. He must be a fan, you know, to sort of do that, which is ace. And Lord of the Rings is stunning and amazing and groundbreaking.
Yeah.
But... would he be expensive? That's my thing.
Well, he says he'll do it for the price of a Dalek, didn't he?
So, did he?
I dare say they can afford that.
Yeah. 50 quid. How much does Dalek get paid? How much does Dalek get paid?
Oh, it's just been slave traded. Yeah, hasn't got a say.
Hasn't got rights. What's the living wage for a Dalek? Doesn't need to eat, does it? Really, just kill people. A death a week. I don't know.
Yeah, you just give him a line of extra shoot every now and then. Probably be all right.
Yeah, so that was bizarre.
Yes, an odd wish list there. I'd be surprised if much of that is fulfilled in the coming seasons, but you never know.
I did like Gus the computer, though, on the Orient Express. Whose voice was it? I think it was quite a famous person, wasn't it?
Wasn't it? Who's that incredibly smug bloke? Scottish.
That incredibly smug Scottish bloke?
Yeah, friends with Browner and Stephen Fry and all that lot.
Oh, God.
His name escapes me.
Yeah, if he's smug, it's irrelevant, isn't it? But yeah, he was quite good, I suppose.
Yeah, yeah. I'm not sure he's worth a return at this late stage in the game.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I'm just trying to make some out of it, Jim, because it was bizarre.
Yeah. It's obviously he had the help of some kind of psychotropic substances when he wrote that. Either.
Exactly.
Anyway, we shouldn't mock these people.
No, we should help them.
They're written in, and
it
wasn't just Gus. Yeah, we should make it our task to find him and help him.
But that's about it, isn't it, for letters this week, Jim?
That's it this time, yeah, a rum bunch. But interesting to see what the topic will be next time. I suppose people will be talking about the new companion. It may even be announced by the time. But of course, Doctor Who magazine's always quite a bit behind, isn't it? So
well, this is April, isn't it? So it's like, it's the future. I mean, I know it's a time travel show, but, you know, we're still...
Yeah, the month on the front of the magazine is ahead.
Yeah.
And the content is a couple of months behind.
Really behind. But we do what we can with it, and hopefully we've entertained you from talking our thoughts.
That's all we seek to do, is to entertain.
Indeed. So, anyway, thank you for listening to the Letter Lords. I've been Bob Fleming.
I've been Jim Cameron, and we shall regale you with more letters next month.
Daddy, bye.
Ta-ra.
Hey, you know what? Hey, you know who likes trucks? You know who likes Americans trucks? Like trucks. Americans like trucks. British people like trucks. British people living in America like trucks. Yeah. American guys living in Brent guys living in... No, they don't like trucks so much.
Hi, I'm the Doctor from Dark Odyssey. I don't drive a TARDIS, I drive a 4x4 Chevy with a Hemi engine. We're selling trucks left, right, and center. 0% financing, 84 months to pay. Come get those Chevys. Come get it while it's hot. Coming at ya, Doctor Who! I'm the Dark Odyssey Doctor Who. Come see me at the No Frills at McAllen and Lawrence. We got lots of free soda.
Now available on the internet, where there's no way to delete it. Doctor Dark Odyssey.
Well, welcome to another edition of Who Teaks Roadshow. I'm here today with Jono Park from Across the Ditch in New Zealand. Hello, Jono.
Hello.
How are you going?
I'm really well. It's nice to be back on the air again.
It's been a little while since there's been a Zeus pod, isn't that right?
It is, and I keep on getting people on Twitter sort of texting saying, are you still around? Are you still alive? I am still alive. I'm a new father, so approaching the 6-month mark now of fatherhood and about to feel like I'm sort of coming out the other side of it. And Zeus Pod will be returning, I promise.
Well, congratulations on both counts.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Now, that kind of nixes my next question, actually. I nixed my own question, which was where some listeners might know you from in the Hooniverse, and it's from being the host of Zeus Pod, I imagine.
Yeah. When did we start Zeus Pod? It was, goodness, just before Series 8. So what was that? mid-2014, and it was actually based on a sort of fanzine, I guess, that was created by myself and a guy based in Wellington called Peter Adamson. Mm-hmm. And it was kind of based around I'm not sure if you have these in Australia, but pub meets.
Yes.
Cool. Yeah, so they were quite big in New Zealand around the mid-2000s-ish, and we decided to create a throwaway fanzine that was basically printed on a piece of A3 paper. It was folded up into a nice little pocket size, and you could read it and throw it away that night, or use it as a bar coaster, or you could actually take it home and, you know, have a have a read later on. That went for a wee while, I think around series 2-ish. Everything's based around series for me in terms of Doctor Who history.
It's a good way to remember things.
It is. I just remember like lots of conversations about, you know, how bad Fear Her was. And, you know, even at the time, thought it was terrible. And so then that sort of folded, and we sort of talked about it for ages, and we did a little bit of a blog for a while, and then we decided, you know what, the one thing we haven't tried is a podcast. So we did that, and Series 8 happened, and Series 9 started, and then, like I said, yeah, fatherhood came along. But plans are in place to get everything back on track. So Zeus Pod has had an 18-month hiatus. Not really 18 months, but it sounds better. And we'll be back soon.
Good, good. Because I miss it. And is it fair to say that you are the only New Zealand podcast? For Doctor Who, at least?
Well, yes, we were. There's another Doctor Who podcast actually run by Peter, who's the guy I started Zeus Pod with, and Dave Renane, who's also a regular contributor, called Beyond the Sofa, which I'd actually recommend as well. It's great. They kind of took over the mantle when Zeus Pod sort of went on ice for a bit.
Oh, fantastic. I'll have to look that up because, you know, it was only earlier today I thought, you know what, I should jump on iTunes and put some, you know, some comments in on some of the podcasts I listen to because I'm terrible at doing that. I'm always asking people to do it for me.
Yeah.
And there are so many, even more than I remembered from last time. And it's very hard to keep up unless you get a sort of a personal recommendation. So I'll certainly look those guys up.
It is amazing how many there are. Like, I'm assuming everyone, you know, has listeners and are doing it because people are listening. There are so many. The minute you go into iTunes and just type in Doctor Who, it's insane.
It is insane.
You know some of the big ones, obviously, like your show and Radio Free Scarrow and all that sort of thing, but all the others, there are so many others, and lots more on SoundCloud as well that aren't even on iTunes. So good on all those podcasters who are doing all those, and, you know, I hope they're all having as much fun as we've been having on Zeus Pod.
Definitely. And there's such variety as well. It's incredible what people pull out, you know, whether it's a more fanzine-based sort of show, or whether it's reviews, or whether it's a comedy-based, sketch-based. There's all sorts of things out there. It's
a bit of Star Wars thrown in, though not anymore. You know,
not anymore. That
rest in peace. I loved Two Wars. I thought you had the best logo.
Oh, thank you. I did too, actually. I miss it sometimes, but then other times I think, oh no, I'm glad just to be concentrating on Doctor Who.
Yeah.
But anyway, this is all about you, not me. So what have you got for us today for Who Teaks Roadshow?
Well, I have got, on the face of it, quite a standard, boring item. It is a copy of the Target novelisation of The Five Doctors. Second edition.
Yes.
A little tatty around the edges because it was the very first novelisation I ever bought when I was 8 years old. And it was around the time in New Zealand, around the 25th anniversary. And I'm not sure if you had this in Australia as well, but you could buy a Doctor Who novel, I think for like $4 or $5, and you got another one free.
Wow.
It was amazing.
I don't remember that. I remember the pricing. I remember like $4.95 as the sticker on the back, but I don't remember getting one for free.
They had they were amazing. And they had did you have the little 25 anniversary stickers that were stuck on the front of them as well? They were like orange and yellow. And you could never get them off, so you could either choose to keep them on there or you know, risk ripping the cover. You didn't have those? Was that just a New Zealand thing?
I vaguely remember stickers for the 25th anniversary, but maybe more on the reference type books than the novels. You're really stretching my memory now.
Yeah. Well, this one is not stickered.
Very good.
This edition. Mm-hmm. Shall I go into more detail about what makes it special?
Well, indeed, that was going to be my next question. Why you've picked this? I guess you've foreshadowed a bit by it being the first one you've ever bought. Is that the big reason, or is there other reasons?
Well, that was kind of a sentimental reason, I guess. However, the reason why I find it so special is that in 1990, September 1990, there was a convention, the one and only sort of Doctor Who convention that ever really happened in New Zealand up until you got into sort of the Armageddon Pop Expo kind of things. And the guest of honour at that convention in Christchurch, it was called WhoCon, was a certain Mr. John Pertwee.
Oh, I think I can tell where this is going.
Now, John Pertwee wasn't actually brought over for the convention. Bizarrely, he was in Christchurch judging the City Council's scarecrow competition.
I knew Wurzel it had to Gummidge. Be Wurzel Gummidge related.
It was bizarre, because part of Wurzel Gummidge was filmed in New Zealand.
Yes, of course.
Wurzel Gummidge down under. And so he was there for that, and they managed to get him to come along to a Doctor Who convention. And I met him, and I got John Pertwee in September 1990 to sign my book. And that book was The Five Doctors.
Fantastic.
So it is a copy of The Five Doctors signed by John Pertwee. Now, I think that's a reasonably good story. The other guest of honour, also in The Five Doctors, can you guess who it was? And I'll give you a clue. The person now has quite a strong New Zealand connection.
Oh.
In fact, they live here.
Well, I know people who have strong New Zealand connections, but that's through the Hobbit and Lord of the Rings and things. But from Doctor Who?
Mm-hmm. They were in The Five Doctors. They live in New Zealand now. He is part of the National History Unit. He's now director. Mm-hmm. Only Mr. Mark Strickson.
Wow.
He plays Turlo. And he was there as well. I think he put to Jonathan,
mm-hmm.
Mark Strickson. John Pertwee put John Pertwee big. I'm not sure if you've ever seen John Pertwee's autograph, but it's quite flamboyant, like the man himself. John Pertwee, Doc 3.
Nice. Well, you know, there's a listener to our podcast out there called Mango Frog on Twitter. She's in New Zealand. And she was just saying the other day that there needs to be more Doctor Who conventions in New Zealand. So she's going to love this story. It's going to give her impetus, I think, to really push for a convention.
Well, do you know what? We've all got our jobs outside of podcasting, right? So we actually have, you know, proper jobs in the real world. And my job is I actually run an events company. And I've always had in my head this idea of actually putting together a proper, not sort of, you know, Babylon 5, Star Trek, Hercules related, you know, convention, a proper Doctor Who convention with just Doctor Who stars. And I'd love to do it. I'm just not sure how many people would go or who would come or where it would be or how much it would cost. Just those, you know, minor details.
Well, I guess when Peter Capaldi went over there, it wasn't for a Doctor Who convention per se, it was more a public appearance just about him. You know, that must have got a bit of a crowd, I would think.
It did. Do you know what? That was the one night that I had two events on that night. I couldn't actually go to see Peter Capaldi because I would have loved to have. And do you know what the best part about it was? Pretty much anyone who lined up to see him afterwards got an autograph and a photo, which was pretty amazing.
And knowing him, probably a sketch or two as well.
Yeah. I would. I missed out on being in a flight. He flew down to Queenstown soon after. He did that bit with Peter Jackson.
Yeah.
And then he went holidaying in Queenstown and I missed his flight. I was flying down to Queenstown the same day as him and I was on the flight after him. Which is rather frustrating.
It would be.
Yeah.
It would be. But let's rewind a bit, because this is very similar to last Hooteek's Roadshow, where David Kitchen had met some doctors and got them to autograph his copy of Time Frame.
Ah.
So for you, what was it like approaching your first doctor?
So I was, how old was I then? 10. I think when you're 10, you know, I think if it had been Peter Davison at that point, because it was around 1990, sort of like the Peter Davison, Colin Baker, Sylvester McCoy stories were all screening on TV.
Yes.
I think maybe that would have been a little bit more overwhelming. I think at that point, John Pertwee was still an old doctor from the old time of the show, and I hadn't really seen any of his episodes. He did a speech. He did like a two-hour, you know, Q&A, which was absolutely full. And I was in the front row of that, and there's a video. You could buy a video afterwards of the whole convention. And you can just see me just sort of getting more and more bored as the time goes on. And then I walk out. I walk out of John Pertwee, you know, regaling this room of 200 people. And do you know what I went to go and see? They had a video room a couple of doors down. And I went to go and watch The Keys of Marinus because I'd never seen it before. What the hell was wrong with me?
I thought you were going to say Delta and the Bannerman or something. No. That would have been even worse.
Oh, no, I'd seen that and loved it. but that was quite bizarre. Why would I do that? I mean, now you wouldn't even think, you know, John Pertwee. well, you don't really have the opportunity with John Pertwee, do you? But
no,
but I'm just so annoyed with myself at the time. So, but I remember meeting him, and they did the signing out by a swimming pool, and it was at like the airport travel lodge in Christchurch. So, you know, not the most exciting of environments. Mm-hmm. And I remember standing and getting my autograph, and I don't really remember much else about him, really. He seemed very nice.
Yeah.
It was quite bizarre. I think your priorities. I mean, I was a 10-year-old kid at a science fiction convention, you know, and at that point, things are just more interesting. Like, I don't know, watching an old episode, something you've never seen before, in some, you know, grotty old screening room, is kind of more exciting because it's something, you know, this is part of the history of the show I've never seen, rather than an actor talking about the time on the show. Do you know what I mean? Like, it's...
Yeah.
Yeah.
I do. It's, but now, as you say, you look on it now and think, oh, I did that. It gives you a unique story, I've got to say.
Well, it's true. I mean, I think I was more excited to meet Mark Strickson because, you know, Turlo, for me, was quite a recent companion.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the Davison stories, they were about end of 88, early 1989, that they were screening in New Zealand.
Right.
And so he was quite fresh in my memory.
Did you like Turlo as a companion?
Yeah, because I'd never seen the first couple of episodes of Mordred Undead, so I never realised he was a baddie.
Oh!
I just saw... Like, I'd sort of seen him in the five... Like, the Five Doctors, the actual episode, the very first time it screened in New Zealand was on the 25th anniversary, and they screened a different story a week in New Zealand. Sorry, a different story a day. So you'd have 5 days of Doctor Who, and they screened Dalek Invasion of Earth, Seeds of Death, something from Pertwee. I think they screened maybe the Five Doctors, the Doctor and the Daleks film, and Silver Nemesis. And that was where New Zealand saw Silver Nemesis first out of anyone in the world. Because they screened it here first. So it's funny. The Five Doctors just sort of really covered everything in terms of my knowledge of the show. My knowledge of John Pertwee was from the Five Doctors as kind of, you know, the 10 minutes or so he's got on screen there, rather than... Yeah. This whole plethora of stories that he had.
Well, how interesting. I guess we're talking about a Target novel, so I've got to ask the question about buying other Target novels and maybe what the experience was like in New Zealand for that.
They were kind of everywhere, and they were all of that sort of those reprint titles that you always got, not the ones with the new logo on it. They were the proper old ones, but the ones that they just obviously just kept on reprinting. So you could easily find The Androids of Tara, or The Hand of Fear, or The Cave Monsters, or Carnival of Monsters, like all those ones you just see all the time. You still see them now if you go into secondhand bookstores. It's always the same ones there. It's when you started to get into the sort of those later ones where they started to number around the 100, those sort of 90s to 100s. And things like The Savages. For years, I couldn't find The Savages. It was just impossible to find it in New Zealand. The second Dalek Master Plan book, as well, was always really difficult to find.
Yes.
For some bizarre reason, Blow Me Down, I could not find a copy of The Abominable Snowmen, which is random, because that, you know, that's everywhere. there were just certain strange ones I could never find. I had 3 copies of Fury from the Deep, which apparently is one of the more rare... titles. Yes. I had 3 of them. 2 copies of The Wheel in Space.
Now you say had. Did you give them away or sell them? Or
I sold my entire collection. I only had 3 left to go. It was Megloss, Ark in Space, and Abominable Snowmen. 3. I had all the others and got to, I think, about the age of 13 or 14 and sort of gave up on Doctor Who and sold the lot because I thought I'd never find those 3 books.
Oh.
I know. Tell me about it.
Oh.
And then when I got back into the show, kind of like in my mid-20s, I was like, I want to get another collection together. And what were the first 3 books I found? Megloss, The Abominable Snowman, and Ark in Space.
That's couldn't the universe it. Telling you something.
Oh, totally. And even for ZeusPod, actually, last year, we decided to see how easy it would be to build an entire collection from scratch.
I remember that,
whether we could do it in 3 months. And we did. We managed to get not only one, but like almost 2. That was pretty amazing to be able to sort of pull that together. And we sold that for charity, which is great. So I went to a charity here called Books and Homes.
Now, I have a theory on target novels too, and I want to see how you sit with this. Mm-hmm. And that's that growing up with the show, we'd be watching it on VHS or later DVD, repeats on television, because obviously in Australia and New Zealand we were blessed with repeats like the UK didn't get. Mm. But I find the target novels enhanced what I saw on television. Maybe even to the point where I feel more fondly about stories because I read the book and knew the book inside out, knew the story inside out, and not because of what I'd actually seen on television, which might have been quite hammy or quite, you know, you know, the whole wobbly set cliche and so forth. Do you think target novels enhance the way you saw certain stories?
I think they almost, for a long time, even if I'd seen the story, they kind of... What I remembered the story to be was actually more from what I'd read than what I'd actually seen.
Mm.
For example, the great cover, or the great book, one of my favourite books ever, was The Seeds of Doom. And that was a great book, because it was only 120... What was the Terence Dix book length? 125 pages, I want to say.
About that, yep.
Yeah, so the six-parter condensed down into that. So that great bit in Antarctica at the beginning, which is a couple of chapters, and then all the other bits and pieces, and the grinder at the end with Harrison Chase. And everything in my memory of that is from the cover. So when I think of Seeds of Doom, I think of huge explosions and fighter jets and you know, all this, the big crinoid over the house, which is obviously in the show, but it's all, the way I feel about that story is so much more enhanced, what you're just saying, really, from what I read. And it was sometimes, a lot of the times, you read the books, because it's the first thing you'd see, and then you'd see the show and go, okay, that's not what I had in my head.
Yeah.
But the end of Hand of Fear, and the whole thing where they're going through the canyons and the doctor tricks them, and like in the book, that's, you know, really scary, and this place seems enormous, and then you see it on TV and it's a bit of a set, really.
Yeah.
And pretty much the same set, shot from different angles. But I don't think it... I mean, I just have so many memories of reading the books over seeing the episodes, because I didn't really see a lot of the Tom Baker ones. I didn't repeat them enough for you to be able to see them. So I only really saw a lot of them in my 20s, eventually, when they came out on DVD.
Mm. You're talking a moment ago about Terence Dick's page length. Think of something like The War Games, where I think The War Games is one of the thinnest target novels, and it's 10 episodes in there.
The War Games, I think, is the same length page-wise as Planet of Giants. What's that all about? Planet of Giants, actually, hilarious, like, somewhat ironically, they boosted up the font size. So you're reading it, and it feels like a large, you know, large print format book, because they're just, I think they're just trying to fill it out.
and in a similar way to the target's enhancing stories, with some of the Hartnell stories, which I read as target novels first in the late 80s, say, before seeing them on DVD a decade or more later, people have mentioned a certain story, I think, oh, that's a great story. And then I'd realise it's because I'm thinking of the target novel. When I actually saw the episodes, I was like, oh, yeah, this is
Celestial
so
Toy Maker, anybody?
Mm-hmm. That's a good example. Or, I don't know, the Space Museum or something like that. You know,
Space Museum, amazing cover, because it makes you think there are Daleks in it.
Yes. And look, to give it its due, I think the first TV episode is really good. It just goes downhill from there. But I read that novel first. I think it must have been the late 80s that came out. I'm thinking 88 or 89 or something like that in my mind. I love that. But I'd never seen the TV episodes before. So
yeah,
they certainly could skew your perception quite a bit.
I think it was things like The Chase, which reads really well. Because it's sort of going. And then, you you watch it, and by episode two, you're thinking, I could have finished the book by now.
Yeah.
Come on.
So you mentioned you now have a complete Target collection today that you've put together.
I actually have two, and one of them is, the reason why, there's not just because I have become addicted to collecting Target novels, it's because you collect a whole collection, and that's great. And then you see a slightly better copy of Terror of the Vervoids, which hasn't faded along the spine, so you buy that and replace it out, and then suddenly you've got all these double ups. So I've actually got a full set of sort of pristine non-faded, nice condition books, and then kind of the B section.
Well, I haven't gone quite that far. My collection, I've got a lot of really good mint copies of a lot of books, but then every now and then there's a really yellowed, really awful spine.
Some of those Bakers, the Tom Baker ones, are really bad for going brown.
Yes, they are.
Yeah, and then you've got the random ones like Doctor Who and the Mutants, which is a completely different font, size, and Doctor is spelt with a DR full stop, yeah, rather than Doctor. It's all over the place. Don't even get me onto the numbers and the different types of Target logos on the side. Some were black and white, see-through, some were full colour. What's going on?
I think there's a little bit of OCD in most Doctor Who fans, and it drove all of us crazy.
Yep, just a tad.
Now, moving on from the Target books, I guess before we finish up here with some values, it's remiss of me not to ask, did you continue on with the Virgin New Adventures and Missing Adventures or the BBC Eighth Doctor Adventures or any of the other novels that came out after the Targets?
I started with the New Adventures, and I can even tell you which one I think I finished on. It was... I can see all the covers in my head, I just can't remember which one. There are some Kate Orman ones in there. The Left-Handed Hummingbird, is that a...
Was that's one of Kate's?
Yeah. It was a Paul Cornell one.
Yes.
And it was kind of was there like a 50th one? It was like a wrap-up.
Oh, Happy Endings?
I think it was Happy Endings. I think it was the last one that I actually read.
And what made you want to stop on that one?
It was either that I couldn't afford them anymore, because I was only 14 or 15. I think it was probably around the time that I sort of fell out of love for the series. I actually did a fanzine called Talos, and it ran for about 15 issues, I want to say, and you can kind of see, I was rereading them the other day, I found an old box of them, and you can just see between issue 14 and 15 you can almost point out exactly at what point I kind of fell out of love with Doctor Who. Funnily enough, quite soon after the TV movie. Not sure if that's a coincidence or not. But you can see it. It's just like you can suddenly see like all this interest just ebbing away. And I think a lot of people go through that. I'm not sure if you did, but sort of that teenage year thing where suddenly everything else is more important than the show you've liked since you were 8.
Well, for me, it was quite natural because I turned 14 the year the show ended in 89. And so by 1990, I was 15 and there was no show. So it was almost a logical time to sort of drop away from it. Not only because I was thinking more about girls and what I was doing at school and, you know, getting a driver's license in the year or two ahead, but just it does feel like a time in a lot of people's lives where they do give up on the show for a while, but then they come back with a vengeance. So by the time of the TV movie, when I was 21, I was absolutely ready to come back to Who, even though I didn't particularly like the TV movie.
I love that. So like, I'm ready to come back to Who. This is the perfect time. The TV movie. Okay.
I'll put it again. Off for a... Yeah, I know it's not profound to say that, but I loved McGann in it, not much else.
Oh, he was great. And at the time, I really liked the theme song, which I kind of liked the whole, where it sort of had that do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do. It suddenly, like, funked it up a wee bit. You listen back to it now and you go, well, that was not great. but a lot of good stuff in there.
Have you held on to your New Adventure books as well?
I have, and apparently they're worth quite a lot of money now.
Yeah, apparently. Some of them are worth obscene amounts, but on the whole, most of them, in UK amounts, which is where I see them mostly, probably at least 10 to 15 for even the basic ones, for pounds. Mm. All right, look, before we get to pricing, just one more question, and that's, in this era, in the modern era, if I can call it that, do you feel books, and I guess the BBC range is the one that's out there at the moment, books are kind of overshadowed a bit by audio?
Possibly. I have struggled to find a Doctor Who reference book that I've wanted to buy for a long time, or even a... Not, I certainly have never considered buying a novel or a fiction book. Don't know why, just doesn't interest me. I want something like... Do you remember when the 60s came out, and the 70s and the 80s?
Fantastic the David books.
Oh, God, they were so good.
Yeah.
So good. And I, again, found them the other day, sitting in a box, and they're still great. I mean, some of the stuff is pretty outdated, and obviously a lot of research has been done since then, but they're still beautiful books. So lovely.
Yeah, the 90s was a great era for, like, those coffee table type books. They had, like, Blacklight, The Art of Andrew Skillitter. That was a great book. Even the Cybermen book that David Banks got in and sort of wrote this fictional backstory to the Cybermen, even that's good in its own way. It has some great artwork in it, at least. A good era, a really good era. There's a book called Ace. I think it's Mike Tucker wrote it with Sophie Aldred.
Yes.
And it's kind of like reminisces about her years on the show and stuff. I love all those books, you know, and they're really expensive now too.
Yeah, and I actually really, really miss... Can I talk about the 90s? What about the 80s? Where you got great stuff like Doctor Who, the making of a television production, and 25 Glorious Years, and The Key to Time, and... Doctor Who special effects by Matt Irvine. Yeah.
Yes.
So great. I think it's probably the only ever book that's ever had the Colin Baker version of the neon logo as its main logo.
I think you might be right. Yeah.
So good. So good. And also just really, really bad ones like Travels Without the TARDIS, which was the Doctor Who location guide. Oh, that was so bad.
Wasn't it? Isn't the story, it was written by two Americans who'd never been to the UK. There's some strange story about that book.
Yeah, it's quite weird. And let's not even talk about the Doctor Who cookbook, because I think that's just quite bizarre.
Or the Patton book.
Is it the Companions book that some of the photographs in there are bordering on... inappropriate.
Yes. Yes. Particularly on the contents page, as I recall. Yeah. Yes.
Yeah. Anyway.
Alrighty. Let's get around to values. Now, we kind of touched around this earlier.
Before you do that, can I throw in a curveball to your valuing thing? Because I haven't quite told you the whole story. There's some good news and some bad news, I guess, when it comes to this book. The good news is, my kind of goal with this book was, look, if I've got a companion and a doctor, wouldn't it be great to kind of get some more people to sign it who'd been part of it?
Yes.
So that would be quite cool. Patrick Troughton, unfortunately, I was a year out from being able to get him. And it didn't really sort of happen, even though I went to a convention where Janet Fielding was at, forgot the book, so I couldn't get her to sign it. Randomly, and this is actually, if you go to the Zeus Pod page on SoundCloud, last year I was invited to interview Peter Davison. Mm-hmm. And as part of that, I took the book along. And now, as well as the third Doctor, it now has the fifth Doctor's autograph in there as well. So there's another autograph in there for you, just to add it in. Now, fantastic. To balance that out, because it can't all be good, the book also has my wonderful mother's handwriting in it, which says, property of Jonathan Park, because she was worried I'd lose it when I went to go and get the doctor to sign it. So take that into consideration when you're valuing this, because whilst it's brilliant that it's signed by all these doctors, it also has my mother's handwriting in it and my name.
I think that adds to the authenticity that this is a period piece owned by a real fan.
True. Okay. I didn't think you'd say that, but that's great.
Well, let's look at the paperback itself. I think as a paperback, it's probably about $8 to $10, I think, would find you that book. You know, if you dig around, you may even find it cheaper. You may find people trying to sell it for more. In fact, this weekend, I have found a hardback copy of The Five Doctors, first edition.
Wow. And
the person is trying to flog it for $180.
Ooh.
Now, you know, I'm not sure that's good value or not, but I guess it's in the eye of the beholder. If, you know, you really, really wanted the first edition hardback and you had $180, there is one out there this weekend.
There is somebody in New Zealand, I won't say his name, who owns every single hardback novelisation.
Oh, wow.
Isn't that mad? I've only ever come across about three, and even those were all ex-library ones, so they were covered in, you know, tape and stamps and everything.
Yeah, I had an ex-library Mysterious Planet for some reason for a few years, but it's long gone. But yeah, well, that actually wouldn't be a full collection of books, though, would it? Because I think they stopped making hardbacks before they finished the range.
They did. So a full collection of books that you could actually physically... I think the last one was like The Smugglers or something.
But anyway, something random.
I digress.
So anyway, if we take the book to be worth about $10, but then Pertwee's autograph, I think that's got to be about at least $100 or more these days in books.
Wow.
You know, when I look around and I see say it's Moon Boots and Dinner Suits or something signed by John Pertwee, I think you're looking at least $100.
Goodness.
If not more for that. A Peter Davison at a convention, maybe at the low end 30, anything up to probably 50 for his autograph. So I think the combination of those, with a Mark Strickson thrown in, I think, not that you're wanting to sell it at all, but I think it's easily over 200. It's probably in the region of $250 at a rough guess.
Well, if I'm going to do the typical reaction of somebody from Antiques Roadshow, oh gosh, I had no idea. I'm never going to sell it, but oh, it's good to know. I'm going to sell it.
You can tell they are. You know, you can tell the ones who will.
That's got sentimental value. This actually does have sentimental value. And, you know, I think the fact that it's got my name written plastered through the inside front cover means that it probably will only ever be special to me. But yeah. Good to know. Need to try and get some more of those doctors in as well.
Oh, I think so. I think if you could add some more... Doctors,
here's a question for you, because I had the opportunity, actually. Would you put Tom Baker's signature in there if you had the opportunity to? Because technically he's in it, but technically he wasn't.
Oh, isn't that interesting? Yes, I would.
Okay.
Yes, because he is in it.
Okay.
You know, I think it, you know, I was trying to think of a clever answer, you know, only if it was in crayon, maybe, to replicate his wax statue or something at Madame Tussauds.
Brilliant.
But
the funny thing is, like, what I'm finding interesting is that as the years are going on, and it's quite sad, really, the number of people who are involved with the Five Doctors are getting slightly less and less. No Liz Sladen, no Nick Courtney anymore, nope. No Anthony Ainley.
No J&T.
No J&T, no Baruza, no... I think even... am I right in thinking that Chancellor Flavia is no longer with us anymore?
I think so, and apologies if she is listening.
Sorry. But yeah, it's interesting. It's quite alarming how opportunities to kind of meet people that you want to meet are becoming less, fewer and fewer from the old series.
Yeah, I think Terence Dix might have been in Australia last year, and I missed him. I might be misremembering that. I've got an awful feeling he was, and I missed it. And I sort of kicked myself about that, because I would really like to meet Terence Dix.
Yeah, he'd be great.
Anyway, thank you so much for talking to us about Five Doctors and Target novels and collecting things in New Zealand. I think it's been really, really interesting.
Oh, thank you. I've rambled on a little, I feel. I guess I'm just glad to be back.
Thanks so much, Jono.
Pleasure.
Welcome to the TARDIS Library, a place to talk comics, novels, audios and more from the worlds of Doctor Who.
Hi. Welcome to the Doctor Who Library. This month, I'm going to be looking at issue 2 of the 12th Doctor Year 2 comic. Plus, I've also had a chance to look at the premiere issue of the brand new 4th Doctor miniseries, which comes out on the 23rd of March. So let's deal with the 12th Doctor first. It's part 2 of Clara Oswald and the School of Death by Robbie Morrison and Rachel Stott. I think I forgot to mention the name of the story last month, which has to rank up there as one of the most unexciting and lazy ones I've seen for a long time. At least Curse of the Fatal Death was meant to be an affectionate homage to the story titles of the classic era. This is just nothing. No wonder Titan stuck it at the end of the issue. If I'd opened the comic to the first page and read that, I'm not sure I would have carried on. Anyway, we left things last month with Clara undercover in the mysterious Raven Scour school in the wilds of Scotland, looking for her missing friend. Doctors hiding under the bed, and the PE teacher and his pupils are being menaced by green amphibious lizard things that hatched out of some eggs they found in the cave. We pick things up the next day at assembly, when Mr. Beck, the PE teacher, seems to have had a personality transplant and become as compliant and as aloof as the other teachers. In fact, most of the pupils in Clara's first English class seem to be acting very oddly and certainly don't appreciate it when Clara tries to deviate from the set texts. It's worth mentioning here that there's a very clumsy page where Clara gives a speech about the validity of television and graphic novels as valid art forms. It's nice and all, and I totally agree with the sentiments, but it just seemed totally out of place with the context of the story. So, Clara befriends Jack and Lucy, a couple of pupils that still seem to be normal, who don't seem to want to talk about the disappearances beyond saying that people are bedevilled, like those from an ancient legend, and they warn her to stay away from the water. Meanwhile, the Doctor goes down to the local pub called the Slaughtered Whale. The
try and find out more, and he ends up revealing that at least some of the villagers are less than human than they first seem, and he gets into a fight using a stuffed swordfish as a weapon. It's very funny and very reminiscent of the modern show, and excellently illustrated by Rachel Stott. There's a few very good pages here. And once again, it's the 12th Doctor's snappy dialogue where Robbie Morrison excels. His Doctor sounds very like the television version, which he's just as well when all the other main characters seem very bland so far. The school's then visited by current Prime Minister and ex-pupil Mr. Claremont, perhaps a reference to classic X-Men writer Chris Claremont. He also seems to be part of the conspiracy at the school. And Clara eavesdrops on a private dinner and hears them talking of washing away the trappings of humanity. But before she can hear any more, she's startled by the arrival of Jack and Lucy, and the three of them barely escape into the caves below the school. A sudden tidal wave washes them down into what appears to be a cave from prehistoric times, and they barely have time to catch their breath before something devilish rises from the water. Cue the end titles. So, it's all very well done, and I can't really fault the writing and the art, and there's a beautiful splash page of the lush cave environment near the end. But there's two main problems I have with this comic. And firstly, for a comic that's named after him, the Doctor's only in a third of the issue. Admittedly, much like part one, those are the best pages in the story. But I would like to see more of the Doctor doing stuff and less of Clara. There was enough of that in the TV show. Secondly, I think you can all work out who the monster is at the end of the issue. But I'm not sold on the redesign. It's all a bit generic, and when you have the infinite possibilities of the comic medium without the restrictions of budget or having to put men in rubber suits, it's all a bit disappointing. One last thing to mention is the main cover by Alex Ronald, who I've come across in 2000 AD in the Judge Dredd magazine. It's really a stunningly moonlit painting of the 12th Doctor against the background of the school on the clifftop. It's an excellent, excellent cover, and it's guaranteed to stand out on the shelves. So, that's the 12th Doctor number 2. And now we move on to issue 1 of the eagerly anticipated 4th Doctor miniseries. Now, I have hugely fond memories of the original Doctor Who Weekly Tom Baker strips, things like The Iron Legion and City of the Damned. So it'd be interesting to compare this more modern take to that most classic of eras. The creative team on this series, which is titled Gaze of the Medusa, is Gordon Rennie and Emma Beebe as writers, and Brian Williamson as artist. Now, Rennie I'm very familiar with, as he's had an extensive career in comics, particularly in 2000 AD, where he created well-remembered series such as Missionary Man and Cabalistics Inc. and Cursed Earth Coben. And he's also done a lot of work for video games and in the Warhammer universes. Emma Beebe's a more recent name, and she and Gordon often work in partnership on stories, it seems now, again in 2000 AD. And she's notably become the first female writer on Judge Dredd in the character's 40-year history. Oh, and they've also written some audio plays for Big Finish, so they've got history with the character. Brian Williamson I'm less aware of, although looking at his website, it seems he's done a lot of work for Titan before, on their Primeval and Torchwood strips, plus some Doctor Who covers, so he should be used to getting actors' likenesses right. The comic stars Tom Baker's incarnation of the Doctor, obviously, along with fan favourite Sarah Jane Smith. It's apparently set sometime after Periods of Mars, so plenty of scope to fit in extra adventures. And it's also evoking the tone of the Holmes-Hinchcliffe era. So, at the start, we're in London, 1887, where the Doctor and Sarah are taking in Buffalo Bill's Wild West show. Meanwhile, a veiled lady in black sends her one-eyed, 8-foot-tall alien servants out into the foggy streets looking for the recently arrived time travellers. Trying to fight off the Cyclopean monsters, Sarah Jane's captured, and the Doctor's felled by some kind of stun ray projected from the alien's hands. But before he can be captured too, he's rescued by Professor Odysseus James and his daughter Athena. Well, she does more of the work, to be fair. Taken back to the Professor's laboratory, the Doctor learns that, like many eccentric scientists featured in the show, he has some wild theories about the origins of the creatures. Plus he reveals he's discovered evidence of time travel, or as he calls it, chrononautology. Meanwhile, Sarah Jane's taken back to the mansion of the mysterious Lady Emily Carstairs. Although she tries to deny it, Lady Carstairs knows that she's been travelling in time. She takes Sarah Jane to a gallery of treasures, a series of statues that are thousands of years old, yet appear to be of people in contemporary dress. And wouldn't you know, one of the statues is... Well, that would be telling. So, Having read the issue, what did I think? Well, it's pretty good, but it's not without its flaws. The storyline's not the most original. All of time and space, everything that's ever happened or ever will, and we end up back in Victorian London, again. The Doctor's even wearing the Deerstalker hat from Tellens from Wang Chiang. When your front page declares that the Doctor and Sarah Jane must face the Medusa's gaze, it's not hard to figure out where this is going. And we have another wacky scientist with another plucky daughter. It's all very traditional. But maybe that's what people want from a Fourth Doctor comic. I was just hoping for something more. Rennie and Beebe have a good handle on the Fourth Doctor and his mannerisms. There's a couple of nice scenes where he's babbling to himself and name-dropping all the historical figures he's met. And when he's told where Sarah Jane's located, he exclaims, "Chiswick, this could be worse than I thought." It's very Tom Baker. Likewise, Sarah Jane sounds like she does in the show. Art-wise, it's more of a mixed bag. Williamson is a bit of a looser, more scratchy style than some. But I do wonder how much he's taken from photo reference, even the backgrounds. There's a fair few panels of the Doctor where a keen eye could probably match them to screen grabs from the series. And one in particular where the Doctor's shaking hands with Professor James is incredibly reminiscent of something I've seen elsewhere. I just can't recall it. My memory's not what it was. I mean, it's not the ridiculous levels of the infamous Rocky Horror Picture Show comic book adaptation, where they just traced photos from the movie. But it is a bit jarring in places. Nowhere is this mix of photo reference and freestyle artwork more evident than in the final panel, and Sarah's Jane's reaction to what she sees. It's almost like two different artists were involved. So in conclusion, while it's great to see new Fourth Doctor adventures in comics, it's a bit of a shaky start for this series. Hopefully things will pick up and the story will move off into more original territory. And the art? Well, let's see. So, sincere apologies for both my reviews containing a little bit of negativity there, but that's sometimes the way these things go. And, you know, although I didn't like some parts of the story, there was a lot to enjoy. That's enough from me for now. See you next time.
From writer-producer Andrew Chalmers of Dark Journey, who has nothing to do with this travesty of a production, comes Doctor Who, Dark Odyssey.
The name is Who? Doctor Who! I'm the last of my time race of Gallifrey, adrift amongst the stars, a wanderer in the sixth dimension, alone. Except for you, Natalia.
Kiss me like you've never kissed me before. Oh. Oh. Oh.
Oh, yeah!
Well, well, my half-brother. The Doctor is back! More moral indignation to cast my way, ha-ha!
The only thing that is indignant about me is my indigestion.
What?
My indigestion, as in, you disgust me.
I don't get it.
I'm a Time Lord, and I'm here to say, I save the universe in the most unusual way. With my sonic rock and my psychic gun, I roam the universe killing alien scum. Alien scum, yeah, alien scum. I roam the universe killing alien scum.
If you think showrunner Stephen Moffat is ruining Doctor Who, wait till you hear what M.A. Tamburo does to this beloved science fiction franchise.
My power, my pleasure, my pain, baby.
Yeah!
Doctor Who, Dark Odyssey. It's magic. Magic.
I compare you to a kiss from a rose on the grave.
Oh, the more I get of you, the stranger it feels, yeah. And now that your roses and tulips, and then there's room and there's grayness and gloom, and the rain and the gray colors. I love Seal so much.
Oh. Oh, so strong.
You can uphold my constitution, Natalia.
You know how to talk to a woman.
Oh, yeah.
Well, here we are at the end of the third Doctor Who show, and my thanks as always go to the team, Ian, Bob, Jim and Kevin, for their ace contributions this month, as well as our special guests, J.R. Southall from the Blue Box Podcast and Jono Park from Zeus Pod. There was no new 10th Doctor comic in the past month, so you didn't hear Mark Suter's dulcet tones from the US this month, nor an 11th Doctor comic review from Lex. While there was a comic to review, her heady social schedule got a bit out of hand and she couldn't file on time. Hit her up at Lexiness on Twitter and tell her you miss her. She promises to be back next issue with her own unique take on those comics. She might even be doing two by the time we're doing our next episode. Right now has normally been the part of the show where I take an issue and wax lyrical for a few minutes this month in the hope that someone will write in to me about it. But this month, I want to dip into the mailbag and read some of your feedback on our episodes so far, basically episodes 1 and 2. As always, the best place to reach us is hello@thedwshow.net if you do want to say something. And look, let's just get straight into it. For the first one, good evening, Rob. I finished listening to the latest Doctor Who show and am very happy with how my piece turned out, so thank you again for the chance to do it. Well done for the podcast. I thought number 2 was just a little tighter and more confident than the first and worked really well. Onwards and upwards. Regards, David in Melbourne. That's David Kitchen writing in. We had him on Who Teaks Roadshow in episode 2 if you've not heard it. Go back and have a listen if you've not. It's a really good little segment. Thank you, David. What else have we got? From Doc Hume. A good show this week. I'm almost used to the individual sections, letter lords, etc. And we're only 2 eps in, which I reckon means it's working. Well, thank you, Doc. And I think it's working too. A lot of podcasts, Doctor Who podcasts particularly out there, are very panel-based, and that's great. I love listening to panel-based shows. When I talk about Proctor Who or Blue Box Podcast or, you know, whatever it might be, it's usually at least 2 or 3 or 4 people chatting. But we are a little different. We do individual sections. Hopefully they're still chatty enough that the chatty vibe is here, but also the fanzine vibe is here, and hopefully it's something different. And being only monthly, hopefully everyone can have time in their schedules to hear us at least once a month. Anyway, that's me waxing lyrical about the show. Let's have another letter. Here's a longer one from John Hull. Hi Rob, another good show. I enjoy the comics reviews, particularly as I don't think I'll ever afford them or have time to read them. Your question at the end made me think for a moment. There was a Star Trek crossover comic, and I would love to see Mulder and Scully in the TARDIS. The episode we had last week was with Rhys Darby and was a good mix of comedy and horror. I'm not sure it always worked either. This was back when the X-Files miniseries was airing. It does still feel like Chris Carter's baby to me, and the production of Doctor Who is interesting. So much of the focus is on Stephen Moffat, but there was also Piers Wanger, Beth Willis, and now Brian Minchin, not Tim, nice one, John, helping too. I wonder what kind of influence they have, or is it just to take some of the heat? Thanks from John. It's a good question, John. I think, obviously, Stephen Moffat doesn't do everything, even though this title of showrunner sort of suggests he's, you know, Eddie everywhere. But he wouldn't be. There are all these other people doing very real jobs in the background. I think the showrunner, both Russell T. Davies and Stephen Moffat, has essentially been like a head writer sort of role, or a script editor sort of role, more than anything. There are elements of producer in the sense of, you know, they'll often stand up and be the mouthpiece for the show. So there's elements of that side of the producer role, plus head writer / script editor. But yes, there are other people. There are actual producers. There are actual script editors, indeed, who are also working on the show in conjunction with the showrunners. So I guess they make the showrunner look really, really good. And for those who have not heard the comment that John is basing his comments on, go back to episode number 2, and I was talking about how Doctor Who does have this showrunner role, and it's very centralised and all the focus is on them, when, you know, a lot of US shows have a writer's room, and it's very, very different. Enables them to do a lot more episodes per year because it's not down to such a small group of people. I guess budgets come into it as well, and the BBC is probably not in great shape at the moment, and maybe for the foreseeable future. But it was just a passing thought as that X-Files miniseries was on TV at the time. Moving on, an iTunes review from Tartan Jeff in the UK. I think I know who Tartan Jeff might be. He says, a fantastic mix of various podcasters and fans all together in one place, and essential for any fan of Who. And better than that, it's fun. Well, thank you, Tartan Jeff. Much appreciated. And can I reiterate to anyone still listening to this podcast, if you are an iTunes user and you can jump on iTunes and leave us a rating and review, that would be so appreciated. It does help boost us in the ratings, which is very important when there are a lot of Doctor Who podcasts out there, particularly some Doctor Who podcasts that aren't even in production anymore. It would be nice to maybe get ahead of them in the rankings so that someone coming along might actually see a living, breathing podcast ahead of one that hasn't made episodes for a year or two or three. That would be really great. Anyway, to finish up, I do want to mention a podcast. It's the Never Cruel podcast. They put themselves out there as a polite podcast, which is a nice way to be, featuring Leon and Matt. I was having a good chat with Matt the other night on Twitter, and he's a lovely guy, and they've got a great little show. Look them up, nevercruel or cowardly.wordpress.com, or just find them straight through iTunes. I think iTunes is probably more up to date than their website. That's something to update, guys. And you can hear two chaps talking politely about Doctor Who, and that might be right up your alley, so do give them a try. All right, that's all for this episode. We've got more reviews, we've got more A to Z, we've got more letter lords, we've got more interviews, we've got more Hootiques Roadshow in a month from now. And as always, if you like what you've heard, tell your friends on social media, write us an iTunes review, write into us. It gives us a sense that this is all worthwhile. Bye-bye for now. You've been listening to The Doctor Who Show, the podcast where too much Doctor Who is barely enough. Subscribe to us on iTunes or listen through the website at www.thedwshow.net. Write to us at hello@thedwshow.net or send us a quickie on Twitter at @thedwshow. Facebook.com/thedwshow is also a good place to find us if you're so inclined. Our version of the Doctor Who theme arranged by George Locke. Look him up on YouTube, folks. This podcast is intended for entertainment and informational purposes only. Doctor Who, all names and sounds, and any other related items are trademarks and or copyrights of the BBC. All other trademarks and trade names are properties of their respective owners. The official Doctor Who website can be found at www.bbc.co.uk/Doctor Who.